ladies and gentlemen, recorded in Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada, it's time for Fight Night Picks with your hosts, Frank
and Matt
Allen.
What a fun, weird, wacky week it was in MMA last week, and I can't wait for the card coming up this weekend. UFC Fight Night, Costa versus Vettori. As always, one half of your hosting duo, Craig Allen, at Craig Allen FNP on the Twitters and the Instagrams. So get the particulars out of the way quick, Matt. You can find Matt at Matt Allen FNP. Keeping it quick, simple, and easy. And Matt, I want to start off by saying this. Last week, I felt kind of re-energized coming into this week. We had such a busy week with Fight Night Picks. You can find us at Fight League Atlantic 2 in Moncton, New Brunswick, Canada. And if the fights didn't end in a submission, honestly, I don't know how they ended. No. It was a lot of fun covering the event there. Derek and the crew with Fight League Atlantic were great. There was a lot of commission members. The fans were very respectful. It was a lot of fun. You can find our coverage at fightnightpicks.com for that one. But there was, again, a wild and wacky week in MMA. We had UFC Fight Night Ladd versus Dumont, the main event. We said it was going to be a stinker. It ultimately was a stinker. We got the underdog pick right in Dumont getting that one. And ultimately, I felt weird watching that main event because as a 12-year-old that played, Pee-wee AA baseball, there was a point in my season when I was 12 where we were winless. We went to a big tournament. Everybody on the team's going to know this part. Our coach sat us out in the outfield in that tournament, told us all we were a bunch of losers, we never amount to anything. Wow. And at that point, the parents decided Coach Terry can't coach the team anymore. And then the parents took over, they coached us, and we started to win some games.
You guys should have toughened up and grew from the experience.
I don't know if that's what Aspen Ladd needs. However, what I do know, out of that and the Bellators, the Bellator 268, our own John Franklin was there covering the event. We ended up with an 8-4 score from question mark kicks to this week in MMA. A little bit of chintzy judging kind of sprinkled in there, but overall, an interesting week of fights. Now, Matt, we move into this one, Costa versus Vettori, and straight up, I love this main event. This is big fight feels here.
I think this is a phenomenal main event. This is a main event that could be like the co-main event to a pay-per-view. Pretty much anything shy of a pay-per-view main event, this could be in that position. And it's just such a great fight. We know how good Marvin Vettori is. He's better than pretty much everyone in the division other than Israel Adesanya. Paulo Costa, the exact same thing. It is really fun. Both guys coming off losses to the champ, who has looked pretty much unbeatable lately. So it'll be really interesting to see what improvements and what advancements both guys have made in their games coming into this main event, because you know both guys are going to be motivated coming into this fight. I know that's always a question mark when a guy loses a title fight and then they kind of take that step back and it's like, what are you going to do next? I think this is a fight that both guys definitely could get up for, and we're definitely excited for a training.
Absolutely should be a great one. You look top to bottom, couple fights that have been jumbled around, and of course we have Laureano Staropoli taking on Jamie Pickett. That was a fight that we talked about a couple of weeks later. But when we look at this one, Matt, from a fight matrix sense, this one actually ranks a little bit higher than our last three cards in terms of their rating system. They've got this one at a 3 out of 5. I definitely agree. A lot of names that some people might not get excited about. Maybe the Ike Villanueva, Nikolai Negomarianu fight. But there's some in there that I'm looking forward to, including our picks for a possible fight of the night, sponsored, as always, by Manscaped. Check them out. Manscaped.com. Use promo code FNP. You're going to get 20% off. And free shipping. Let's throw it on over to the Fight of the Night screen. And Matt, it only feels right that we go with our main event. I mean, listen, we had Marina Rodriguez, Mackenzie Dern. We had Aspen Ladd, Norma Dumont. We had that weird fight that Johnny Walker had against Thiago Santos. Remember that one? This weekend's main event, these two guys will beef and beef and beef all over Twitter. And do they have cool mean mugs? Yeah. And do they have weird, stupid pictures on the internet? Yeah, both of them. For Marvin Vettori, I'd say when he wore his trunks backwards to photo day. For Paulo Costa, I mean, his list is longer than my notes for this card of the weird pictures he has on the internet. But what these guys know how to do is have fun fights. And for Paulo Costa, he's negated guys wrestling in the past. Look at it like when he fought Big Rig, Johnny Hendricks. And for Marvin Vettori, he's negated great striking. Look at it when he fought Kevin Holland. So I absolutely love this fight. I think it's fireworks. And both these guys tend to bring like I said, that big fight feel.
And the great thing about this fight is that I'm not worried about either guy really gassing out in a five-round atmosphere. I know that's something that we talk about a lot, especially with heavyweights, but Marvin Vettori can definitely go a hard five rounds. I don't think anybody in the world is going to argue with that with me. And I actually think Paulo Costa has underrated cardio. He can keep an absurd level of output throughout a three-round fight. So I think that, I don't really think that this is a fight where it's like, oh wow, at the end of the second round, cardio is going to play such a big factor. I think this is going to be a phenomenal fight for as long as it lasts, no matter how long it does end up lasting.
I don't know if I agree with you on all of that, but what I will agree with you on is the fact that these guys always bring it in the biggest opportunities. They've won main events in the past, fight night main events at that. So I absolutely love this fight. I can't wait for it. And if you look at it for our first pick, maybe one guy's won a main event, maybe one guy hasn't. These guys are way off the board. For Jeff Molina, he actually has a fight of the night in his last fight, and that was on a giant card, UFC 261, Molina taking on Archie Long, and it was a great one. Now, he's taking on Daniel Lacerda, a guy that, listen, a lot of fans might know not know Daniel, coming out of Brazil, a ton of first-round finishes, and even in his lone loss, it was due to a shoulder injury, so you know that these guys are well-rounded. This should be absolute fireworks, flyweight never die.
This is going to be an absolutely amazing fight. If you watch Jeff Molina's UFC debut, you know what this guy brings to the table. Crazy output, the willingness to eat shots, to give shots, just gameness, and that's really what we look for when we try to pick out what these Fight of the Night screens are. And if you don't know about Daniel yet, hopefully by the end of our prediction and the full video, you do know a little bit more about him, because he's as exciting as a flyweight prospect as there's been in a meaningful period of time. So I think this is an absolutely great choice for Fight of the Night.
Can't wait for these ones and the rest of the card. As always, check out our Fight of the Night screen sponsor. It's Manscaped at manscaped.com. Use promo code FNP. You're going to get 20% off and free shipping. And I suggest that you do. Plenty of great fights coming up this weekend. We got a couple of different rookie reviews. One for Jeff Molina, and we have him tabbed as a possible Fight of the Night contender in his fight against Lacerda, who's making his UFC debut. Gregory Rodriguez, who took on a game Dusko Todorovic in his last fight. And Matt, I absolutely love these cards. And listen, I normally wait until the fight comes up in this series of videos, but I want to say this. Kasera Sungwoo Choi is one that I have as like a sneaky, like if we had a third Fight of the Night contender, and you can only pick so many, but Kasera Sungwoo Choi might even be my favorite fight on this card.
That's what I mean. You've been kind of hating on the card a little bit, Craig, but I think it's a pretty good one. Like, there's sneaky fights littered all throughout this card, and yeah, it might not have the big name value that, you know, pay-per-views have, but I think there's a lot of really fun ones. Dwight Grant, Francisco Trinaldo. Yeah, Trinaldo's the age of our dad, but he still puts on really, really fun fights, and Dwight Grant is always down to throw down. Like, I really do think that there's some underrated gems littered throughout this card.
Should be a great one. Make sure you follow all the action here on the YouTube channel. We've been throwing out the challenge, and this is the most disappointing part. There's about 50% of you out there that are just hanging around, floating in the wind, just like leaves in the autumn air. Hit the subscribe button. Don't be that leaf. Have a lot of fun, because there's so many people out there that want those Dana White's Contender Series previews. If we reach 30,000 subscribers, you know we're going to add that into the rotation. It's possible. You saw this week in MMA last week with the Bellator coverage. We could be doing that for Contender Series. Everybody wants it. So toss a sub and toss a like if you're liking the content and hanging out with the guys, Matt. I absolutely love this card. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say, let's get into it. I'm going to start this preview and prediction video off with a question for Matt Allen, FNP, as well as you, the audience out there. If you're in your car, if you're on the airplane, if you're on your scooter, then just, I don't know, answer to yourself. And maybe if you're on the plane, that one's going to be a little weird. If you're here on YouTube, comment down below, what does Randa Markos have in the UFC, and why is this fight even happening?
It's a really good question, and it's something that we could probably ask about, like, three different fighters in the roster. Normally, they're the fighters where the personality gets mentioned before the accolades, and Randa Markos is starting to be in that category. I feel like we've been two of the bigger Randa Markos, like, hey, she at least makes improvements, it's not all about the record, like, records are for DJs in MMA, right? If you look a step further, Randa Markos improves. Well, we did say that, but it's been a little while since we've really been able to make that point about Randa Markos.
So when we look at Markos, I have her in the same stratosphere as Sam Alvey. I look at his record and go, what? And he's booked in a fight? Like, this year? What are we doing? And for Randa Markos, she comes into the UFC in a title shot opportunity, against Jessica Penne way back when. And that was a giant fight. That was an awesome fight to go back and watch. And then since then, yes, you're right. I 100% agree. Marcos would add a little wrinkle here. She'd add something to her game. Now, she was mostly training in the Windsor area, a little bit in Detroit. You know what I mean? Hanging out, hanging tough. And now she's on a 4-fight losing skid. It hasn't been win one, lose one. And it's a really weird skid too, because she loses to Amanda Ribas. She loses to Mackenzie Dern. She loses to Kanako Murata. She loses to Luana Pinheiro. Her last time out, a legal up kick. That rocked Pinheiro. And I know both women were having success in that round. We had Pinheiro to win that fight outright, big time. And unfortunately, you know, you get it right, but at the same time, you don't want to see somebody win by an up kick. But the weirdest part about that fight was that Marcos wasn't training, you know, in and around Windsor and Detroit, because she couldn't go back and forth around the border. She was training full time at Team Luter with Travis Luter, which surprised me. And for this camp, getting ready for Souza, same thing. So a little bit of a surprise for me. Marcos, obviously the older fighter in this one. She has much more experience in the cage. She has a losing record. And the weirdest part about this fight, and why I actually think that it's matched quite well, for the Brazilian gangsta, this is a fighter that I thought would climb right up the rankings. And when she came into the UFC, she looked amazing. I mean, losses to very, very good competition. Wins over very good competition. She finishes Alex Chambers in her debut. She beats Sarah Frota when Souza weighed 115.5.
Frota weighed in it like
123 is what Frota weighed for that fight. Then Souza loses to Brianna Van Buren. All right. So you're a good grappler, you have power on the feet, but when it comes to fighting a great pure wrestler in Van Buren, you falter a little bit. She gets a win over Ashley Yoder. I think that's a quality win. But Souza in her last fight looked absolutely lost against Amanda Lemos, and it was so weird because usually Souza will engage even with a striker, and she just didn't look like she was in the fight at all.
It was a really weird performance, because what we've learned at least lately is, what's the best way to deal with a striker, especially one who needs range to get a lot of their strikes off? Pressure them. Get right as close to them as possible. Because if you're really close to me, it's hard to get power shots off on somebody if their head is in your chest. And that's kind of a Lavinia Souza game plan. If she was going to beat Amanda Lemos, she was going to have to strike her way into the clinch, wrestle a little bit, use her jiu-jitsu. But like you said, she just sort of backed up. And backed up and backed up and just kept on eating the power of Lemos over and over and over again. And it was a pretty bad stoppage. Like, she gets dropped, she gets up, she gets dropped again pretty hard. This is one of those, like, where are we now, Lavinia? Because if you lose to Randa Marcos, I'm done with the hype. And I was a big believer in Souza coming into the UFC too. Like, listen, we'll give ourselves praise when we call a fighter's rise. Like, I thought Vicente Luque was going to be good. Craig thought Piotr Jan was going to be really good. I also thought Lavinia Souza was going to be great. And sometimes those fighters that you have really high hopes for don't end up turning out. And the reason I thought she was going to be really good is that the only Invicta fight that I've ever got excited for in my whole life was her versus Angela Hill. And that is the honest truth. And that was a really good fight. It was back and forth. It was competitive. Angela Hill ends up getting signed to the UFC off that fight. She returns to the UFC. And after she returns to the UFC, has one of the greatest women's fights of all time against Jessica Andrade. A lot of people forget that fight. So in my head, I'm like, okay, you had a close fight against Angela Hill. Angela Hill had a close fight against Jessica Andrade. I know we're doing some MMA math here, but let's have some fun. Let's think that Lavinia Souza can go all the way. She hasn't really looked like the overall confident champion that she was in Invicta. It has been weird because she was an extremely aggressive fighter over in Invicta. She was someone who you didn't have to wait for the fight to come to her because she was going to go out there and take it from her opponent. Now she will just sort of wait and wait and wait. Like, even with Brianna Van Buren, for Souza to have success, you would think, okay, at least initiate the takedowns and try to scramble off them. Four scrambles, because just for pure wrestling's sake, you're probably not as good as Van Buren, but if you can mix in your grappling, mix in clinch work, I think she could have had success. She just never really even tried in that fight, and that was what was so concerning.
If you want a really weird trip, and I threw this one out there on Twitter, go to the UFC site and their page that they have for Lavinia Souza, and you go down to the Q&A. It is the weirdest bucket of muscles I've ever seen, because if you look at it for Souza, she has a black belt in judo, a black belt in jiu-jitsu. You know that that's her bread and butter, and you look at the wins that she has from Invicta. A win over Deanna Bennett by finishing the first round. Deanna Bennett's tough as a $2 steak. A win over Hamasaki. She's one of the best female fighters in the lower weight classes, so that definitely holds water with me. Plenty of finish wins if you look at it. She finished fifth place in a Sao Paulo hot dog eating contest. There is that, but she has so many different accolades from the grappling world that for Souza, yeah, it's just like that Matthew McConaughey movie way back when. It's been a failure to launch. I just haven't really seen it out of Souza. So when I look at this fight and I look at the 5-1 in for Marcos, she has a win and it's going back a very long time against Ashley Oder by split decision about 2 years ago. For Souza, those first two on the way into the UFC, 3 years, 2.5 years ago, her last win a year and a month ago over former common opponent Ashley Oder. So both of these women coming off of wins over Yoder and then a loss for Souza last time out by finish for Marcos. Decision, 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 and then, of course, that illegal upkick. Matt, when I look at my notes, again, I'm still really weirded out by this fight with Souza, training with the regular fight team, for Marcos, working that wrestling and grappling with Luter, who, apart from Kevin Holland, is a very good grappling and wrestling coach and was very good in his own career at that. Some would say Michael Jordan-esque. Well, Mike Goldberg would say that. So, Matt, when I look at this fight, I have a look at the odds. Maybe a bit of a surprise. Souza open to minus 150. She's minus 135 or thereabouts right now. For Marcos, the Canadian coming back, plus 130 at open, around a plus 110 or so. I bet you those odds come in closer to par as we get closer to the fight. The votes on Tapology, Matt, what's that? 627 of them, 84% Souza, 81% by decision for the 16% that have Marcos, 78% by decision. So a lot of people figuring this one's going to go decision. It's just who can be the busier fighter here and who's going to impose their will. And spoiler alert, usually it's Randa.
Everything about this fight says that Lavinia Souza should win. Like, if you go off track record, if we go off their backgrounds, Lavinia Souza is probably the more well-rounded fighter. I say she's the better striker in this matchup, too. Although, listen, you would not want to pay to watch either one of these fighters purely strike for 15 minutes. I think Souza has okay combinations, but she's not going to be able to go out there and beat a lot of fighters in the division just with her stand-up. She really is going to have to mix in her grappling to beat most fighters. And the same thing has to be said for Randa Marcos. I know Marcos had that weird fight with Claudia Gadelha, and it was like, oh, we're strikers now, but we're not going to throw punches. We're just going to kind of stand there. It's just been a weird evolution for Randa Marcos because, again, we used to say she's only adding something new to her game. And that felt like the truth up until after the Mackenzie Dern fight. Because in the Mackenzie Dern fight, very odd fight IQ, like we've seen from Randa Marcos in the past. But going into the Kanaka Burata fight, at least we thought, okay, they're both wrestlers, but Randa Marcos is a pretty good MMA grappler. She's got good cardio. This is a pretty good matchup for Randa Marcos.
Kanako's a way better wrestler.
But at least in MMA, with her size, with her experience, you at least thought, okay, if Randa Marcos is going to get a win, this is tailored towards her style. She got completely dominated at what she does best. So now I'm asking myself, okay, what does Randa Marcos go to? What is her plan A for how am I going to go out there and win rounds? Because I think if she goes out there and goes for a lot of takedowns on Souza, you are welcoming Souza into her own world. And it is kind of weird. I think if Randa Marcos plays that, like, looking in the mirror, I'm just defending takedowns mode, she might be able to win this fight just based on her activity on the feet. It's not something I ever thought I'd say, but if she can just be sound enough defensively against Souza, make Souza a little bit more tired than Randa Marcos is. Like you had said, Randa is normally the more active fighter in her fights, and I could see her peppering her way to a decision win. I just have real concerns picking Randa, who is on a 4-fight losing streak. I feel like she is kind of 1 foot in, 1 foot out at this moment, and this is the thing about being on a losing streak like she's on. This isn't someone who's 31 on a losing streak where they've gotten finished by some great fighters. Randa's 36 at strawweight. Like, that's tough, and eventually your age is going to catch up to you, and with her grinding kind of a style, you need your cardio to be as good as it can possibly be. You need your explosiveness to be as good as it can possibly be to have a style like we saw out of prime Randa Marcos, and I just don't think she's in her athletic prime anymore, so I guess I have to pick Lavinia Souza.
Marcos, going back the last 3 years, is 3-7. Like you said, I mean, she's lost her last 4 fights, but in terms of the odds, they're really close, and that's because, again, Randa Marcos is normally the more active fighter. You saw it in that fight against Pinheiro, who I really, really think is going to be a big star in this division. She has such a fun style, but Marcos was able to do all right against her. Pinheiro, her father's the judo teacher. She has a judo black belt. She uses a lot of hip tosses, head and arm throws, whatever. Souza is just a lot of aggression, has that type of, you know, background in her back pocket. It all depends on what Souza comes out. So I want to wait until later on this week to see what Souza looks like on the scale, what she looks like when she faces off. I want to see that stuff. But for right now, Matt, I like the fact that Marcos is fighting out her deal. Again, somebody that's losing four fights in a row, 3-7 in their last 10, and they're over 35 in a lower weight class scares me away. I like the activity out of Reyna Marcos. For Souza, again, you beat Sarah Frota at 123, who, listen, not USADA's best friend. You beat Chambers, that's great. And then again, both of them with wins over Yoder, who's just a meddling 115er that can ruin a hype train. But Matt, for me, again, I like the busier fighter in Reyna Marcos. It's not the most popular pick that's out there. I definitely want to hear from everybody down below in the comments section. I just haven't seen that Invicta Souza. Hopefully we get to see her coming up this weekend. We're split on the pick. You're going with the Brazilian Souza. I'm going with the Afghan Canadian here in Reyna Marcos. We want to hear from you, like I said, down below in the comments section. And as I alluded to, make sure you're checking out Fight Night Picks, question mark kicks. It's going to be before the prelims, 2 hours before, as we normally always do. Didn't do it last weekend, but tune in there. Toss a sub, toss a like. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say. Let's get into it. Coming up this weekend, we have an absolute barn burner. Flyweight Never Die, possible fight of the night between the returning El Jefe, Jeff Molina, coming off a fight of the night performance against Archie Long at UFC 261. That was a giant card. It was the return of fans. It was huge. And he had an awesome debut that a lot of people got excited about. We have a fight night picks. Rather, we have a 15-minute card breaks rookie review for that debut. And Matt, he's going to be taking on the UFC newcomer, Miojo Daniel Lacerda. And Matt, when I look at this guy, I say fundamentals versus the wildness, because if you look at it for Miojo, he trains at ATS team. And that's a team that you see out of Brazil every once in a blue moon. And you go, oh, I think I know a guy that trained. Didn't he fight the other week? Wasn't Daniel in his corner? You'd be right about all of this. His main teammate and a guy that has cornered a lot of his regional scene fights is Alex Oliveira. And I absolutely hate comparing fighters. Daniel Lacerda fights just like Alex Oliveira, and it is so much fun to watch. He opens up in southpaw, and then he'll whip out a couple of kicks. And it's not like, oh, I'm having fun. I'll throw a couple of leg kicks, then we'll switch over, and I'm an orthodox fighter. No. This guy has kicks from the left. He has kicks from the right. I think he's almost a better boxer when he fights orthodox, but he has an absolute fun style. And when this fight goes to the mat, and I know that it's going to go to the mat, Lacerda's one of those guys that might take a little bit too much time with his back on the mat, but he is very active and always fishing for submissions. That's why I think this fight is going to be so much fun.
This fight's going to be insane. If you watch Jeff Molina's UFC debut, watch it again. Like, just do it. It was that good. I highly recommend it, because I got to be honest, I sort of forgot about it. Went back, rewatched it in preparation for these videos. I completely forgot he almost got flatlined in the last 5 seconds of the fight, and I feel like that needs to be said right now, because for as good as Jeff Molina looked in that fight, and he looked great, he drops Archie Lang, he throws this crazy amount of volume, like, everything is pretty much a picture-perfect UFC debut. And then there's like 30 seconds left in the fight, and he eats a few straight shots to the chin that would have put out a lot of fighters, because they are those clean shots where, like, head knocks back, they look really uncomfortable because they're clean on the chin, and somehow Jeff Molina is able to hold on. Now, if it's one of those like TJ Dillashaw, Cody Garbrandt ones where it's like, hey, if there was 20 seconds left in the round, then maybe the whole UFC debut would have been that much more different for Molina. Maybe we would be talking about him being on the receiving end, of one of the greatest comeback wins of all time, because Molina up until the last 30 seconds was basically the flawless flyweight prospect coming in. Like I said, he fought not only a very fan-friendly style, but he fought in a style that you could see match up very well against other flyweights in the division, and that's why I was so excited for Jeff Molina moving forward. Now, when this fight originally got matched up, I was a little disappointed. I was like, oh really, they're giving Jeff Molina a guy who's making his debut? You think they'd try to build off some of the momentum Molina got in his own debut? But I gotta be honest, I'm so excited for this fight. I think it'll be phenomenal.
Let's throw it on back to our 15-minute card breaks rookie review. If you haven't checked out our second channel, link down below in the description. But let's keep that excitement going about Jeff Molina. And then we're gonna tell you about his opponent coming up this weekend. Taking on a really, really dynamic fighter in Jeff Molina, and you can laugh and snicker all you want over on the Instagrams. This was a guy last year that won a couple of awards with his gym, Glory MMA and Fitness. He was the best teammate, he was the most improved fighter, and he really put it on at the end of last year. And I mean, you look at it, he gets the win over Jacob Silva in Contender Series back in August. It was a decision win, and normally
decision winners. He ended up in the UFC. Dana White was really impressed with him. Molina said after the fight, he was walking around, he's like, listen, I broke my foot in the first round. It is what it is. It was a really, really good win for him. But apart from that, this guy's an absolute finisher. You look at him too. I mean, he started his career off 1-2. And since then, he's won every single fight impressively, even in that decision. Very young fighter coming into this one at 23, almost 24. Matt, I absolutely love the fight. I think stylistically, this is a great one. A very exciting fight at 125 pounds. I can't wait to get your thoughts.
I know we both love the flyweight division, and I think the thing that I love most about the flyweight division is the fact that really only one or two wins can get you into that top 15. And I do think we're dealing with two very exciting young prospects who do have a chance to get into that top 15. Now, I'm not saying win this fight and then you're ready for Brandon Moreno or anything, but just this division is so talent stacked that really anyone in the division could beat anyone in the division, regardless of ranking next to their names, and that's why it's so exciting. You had mentioned a little bit about Jeff Molina and just how well-rounded he is at such a young age. And the great thing about Molina is he fights like a fighter who is much older than he already is. We talk a lot about, oh, well, this fighter, we like a lot of things about their game, but oh, if they could just get it all together, they could just get it all together. Well, at the age of only 23, Jeff Molina doesn't have everything together, of course. He is still a very young fighter, but he fights with the maturity of someone who has had more than just 10 professional fights to their names. One thing I really like about Molina, we were kind of joking about it, I compared him to Zion Williamson, because one thing I really like about Zion is that when he shoots the ball, if he thinks he's going to miss it, he's already got that second jump ready to go up for the rebound. The thing I really like about Molina and his kicking game, to be more specific, is the fact that Molina, he'll throw a kick, and even if you do block it, I think about Israel a little bit, where Israel all of a sudden throws the right kick, and as he's bringing the leg down, he throws the right hand. Well, with Molina, as he's throwing the kick, when he's bringing that down, he's already got another kick ready to be chambered and go right back in. And this is a really neat thing to see from a prospect, because normally you don't see those same side attacks from guys so early in their career. Really, you don't even see it from guys who are into their 30s, who are ranked. So it's just a really nice wrinkle to see out of a guy who is so young in a division that's just so exciting.
So for Miojo Daniel Lacerda, this is a guy, again, he brings that wildness into the cage from ATS team. And I kind of wanted to write it down and give him a little bit of credit, especially the people that are around him. I mentioned Cowboy Oliveira. Felipe Zarcana is another guy. And Andre Tedo, who you might recognize off of regional scene, some bigger fights that he had, but a main coach over there. I just wanted to throw this one at you, Matt, because I found this absolutely insane. Every single fight has ended for Lacerda in the first round, except for one fight in 2018. He knocked out Severino in the second round. His only loss, he injured his arm, his shoulder in that one. So, you know, you kind of look at it 4-1 on the come up, but this is a guy that is so dynamic. I think he's going to be a prospect that's not just going to be a flash in the pan. I think you're going to see him around in the UFC's flyweight division for a really long time.
Oh, I agree 100%. But this is actually a tricky matchup for him. I would be really excited for him coming into the UFC. Let's say if he was fighting, I don't know, pick any aging flyweight that you want who might have like one fight left on their deal. You know what I mean? That classic
Tim
like,
Elliott.
No, maybe not Tim Elliott, because Tim Elliott, I feel like, still has a little bit of tread left on the tires, but you get the idea. Just somebody on their way out. I feel like Lacerda would have one of those debuts, similar to like Terrence McKinney, where it's like, wow, quick finish and we're off to the races. This is going to be a really interesting debut for Lacerda because he's going to have to fight with a crazy level of output in this fight. And that's not something that people making their debut are ever really asked to do. In your UFC debut, ideally, you kind of want to ease into it. You want to ease into that first round, get the jitters over with, understand that, hey, I can eat these shots, I can deal with the bright lights, and then we'll move forward in the second and third round. But when you're fighting a guy like Jeff Molina, it's really hard to get your rhythm down and get your timing down. You're sort of learning on the fly because of all the chaos, and that's why I think this is an oddly tricky debut for Lacerda, even though, let's say he was fighting, I really can't think of any old flyweights. Davy Grant, I guess, is a bantamweight, but
he's a giant bantamweight.
He's a giant bantamweight, too. I'm not thinking of very great examples, but still.
Jerome Rivera.
They're a great one. If he was fighting Jerome Rivera, I think it would probably finish him, and we'd all be talking about Daniel Lacerda like, wow, he's going to be in the top 15 soon. I just think this fight against Jeff Molina is really, really close on paper. I get Lacerda is an exciting prospect, but I feel like a lot of people are getting excited about this new toy in Lacerda, and they're forgetting about all the great things that Jeff Molina can do.
Who are these people? Where are they?
I guess I'm just trying to not let myself get too caught up in the hype by Lacerda, because I look at what he can do on paper, and he's got the submissions. He's got the striking, but normally when you have these prospects who have that like golden talent that you just can't miss, they've always got one little hitch in their game that can be exploited, and I'm worried that a guy like Jeff Molina, who can make a fight ugly, could be able to exploit that in Lacerda's game.
Questionable takedown defense is my one key that I've seen out of Lacerda that I just don't get. Now, you can have bad takedown defense and have
really good jiu-jitsu. And listen, this is a bad example, but not really. Mackenzie Dern doesn't have good takedown defense. There's a reason why she's going to grapple you on the ground unless you're Marina Rodriguez. We'll talk about later on in the show. But Matt, for Lacerda, I just wanted to talk about these things. Really good head movement. Really good high tie stance. Southpaw when he starts. He'll switch over to orthodox. Go back to southpaw. Looks more comfortable boxing, like I said, when he's orthodox. Looks more comfortable with his long-range weapons when he's coming at you from southpaw. A guy that will blitz in to take distance. He'll throw spinning head kicks that normally land, which is kind of strange to see. But again, questionable takedown defense, 5 wins by knockout, 6 wins by submission. And I wanted to focus on that Molina fight against Archie Long. If I could give you some of the scores, the actual scores that the judges had, 29-28, 29-28, 29-27. If you look at it, round three in terms of significant strikes, Archie Long might have rocked him a little bit later on. But the actual numbers, I've never seen somebody in a third round turn it up like Jeff Molina did. Like, Kamaru Usman's a guy that fights on this weird exponential curve where he turns it up as the fight goes
Charles
on.
Charles Jourdain, who... Not against DeRosa.
Yeah, not against DeRosa. But there's a very few select fighters that turn it up as the fight goes on. Shevchenko, maybe a little bit up, or she fights on the same pace. She's a weird anomaly of a fighter. Jeff Molina landed 127 of 122 strikes in the third round.
Yeah.
That's a total you normally see over three rounds. That's in one round. Archie Long, 57 of 125. Crazy, crazy stats. 2% of his strikes in that fight were to the legs. That's something that actually concerns me a little bit against a guy like Lacerda that can use his kicks as a long-range weapon to really open things up. So, I just want, before I head it off to you, I look at the odds for this one very close. Molina opened a minus 170. He's still there. For Lacerda, open a plus 145. He is still at that mark. Again, we look at the votes for this one. 783, 86% Molina, 79% by decision. The 14% that have Lacerda, 36% by decision, 27% by submission, 30% by knockout. Those odds are all relative and weird percentages on Tapology. All of this to say, I think this is an awesomely close fight. I think we're going to get a fight of the night out of this one. I could see, I don't like when people say this, but like a split decision or just a very close decision in the end. I love the fight. I have a hard time with the pick.
I do have a hard time with the pick, but my issue with Lacerda, and this is really my only issue with him, he does have a little bit of that Zabit in him. Like, yes, he does land a lot.
Superstar.
No. But you said, yes, he throws a lot of those spinning kicks. And yes, he does land a lot of them. He does have oddly good accuracy with them. But the issue is that it's hard to rely on spinning back kick accuracy as just something throughout your career. And techniques like that do require a lot of energy. And when you're fighting a guy like Jeff Molina, the first thing I care about is, can you keep a decent pace throughout 15 minutes? And what's the one question that we don't know about Lacerda? I have no idea if he can. Because he's been able to finish guys so quick, which is a great benefit. But this is a question we have about a lot of heavyweights too. How many heavyweights do we have where it's like, hey, all of his wins are by first round knockout, Shane Carwin. What happens after the first round? Shane Carwin. It doesn't look great. Now, I don't think Lacerda's going to have that problem. He's a flyweight. He's not a heavyweight. But you can see where my hesitation is with picking him. I think he has great talent, and I do think that he could get a finish in this fight. It's just hard for me to pick against Jeff Molina because I love the work rate of Molina, and I don't think he's terrible defensively. I know the hands came down a little bit at the end of the Archie Lang fight, but like you said, he threw an absurd amount of volume throughout that fight, so it's just going to happen. You're going to tire.
When I look at it for Lacerda, he was off for a very long time. I chalked that one up a little bit to the pandemic, just the way that things have shaken out in terms of regional MMA. There was also a couple of fights that he had that were shuffled around, one due to injury. So 2020, 2021, a little bit of a weird look. Big win for Lacerda against Rodrigo Sarafian back 2 months and 2 weeks ago. You go back and watch that fight. That's where that questionable takedown defense comes into effect. But a very dynamic fighter nonetheless. I open this video up by saying it's technique versus the wildness. And for me, I like the technique in this fight. Hopefully the fact that that rookie review helped you out a little bit to get an insight into Molina. I think he's a guy that wouldn't squander the 50K bonus that he was able to get at 261. Was that 75K bonuses that night?
I think it was. They deserved it, though. Like, that fight was so good. Go back and watch that fight. I highly recommend.
Fighters deserve less money, Matt. We're one of those. No, I'm just kidding. He deserves all the money he's earned and more. But, Matt, when I look at this fight, I like Molina ever so slightly, but I can't wait to hear from everybody down below in the comments section. Sorry. No, I said Molina.
Okay, no, okay, it made you, okay. It sounded like Lacerda right up until you said Melina.
It's Melina all day. I have Melina in this fight. I see this as a very, very close one, but I want to hear from everybody down below in the comment section because this should be an absolutely insane fight, and hopefully I've hyped it up a little bit. I'm sure these two guys will. They're going to mean mug on the week, and then on the weekend, we get a chance to look back at it with question mark kicks, but both of us right now going with Jeff Molina, El Jefe, to get the win. Matt, big time card coming up. Huge main event with Costa and Vittorius. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
This feels like a must-win fight between two dynamic fighters who are both on two-fight losing streaks, and both of those two-fight losing streaks are finish streaks. You hate to see it, Matt. We have the Death Star, Kama Worthy, taking on the Black Country banger, Jai Herbert. Matt, for Herbert, the former Cage Warriors champ, and listen, I've hyped prospects up before. I've been wrong about prospects before, but I have to say this. For Herbert coming in as a Cage Warriors champ, his two-fight run has been more Chris Fishgold than it is Jack Hermanson. It's been more, I don't know, Craig White than it has Conor McGregor. So when I looked at Herbert coming in, listen, cards on the table, big Cage Warriors guy. I think the production values are great. I think they put on lovely little shows. I think Max Roshkoff could be a star again from his fights over there. I think Spike Carlisle could be something after his big win over JJ Ambrose. But I have to dampen my expectations sometimes. And this is one of those ones where Herbert racked up big wins over big names. Like, it was something to get excited about. And then he comes in and fights an old Masaranduba, and Herb Dean just wanted to see more punishment in that one. And it was disgusting.
Masaranduba might be the violence weight champion in the UFC. That might be a bit of a hot take. It might be a bit of an exaggeration.
We're gonna lose that this weekend.
But that 40-something-year-old man could throw hands. And it was a weird debut, and it was one of those debuts where it's like, okay, former Cage Warriors champion fighting a 40-year-old? We all know how this is going to go, right? Right? And then Francisco Trinaldo, to his credit, did look great in that fight, and he is built like a brick house, which is odd for his age, but still, Trinaldo looked good, and it was a weird fight for Jai Herbert, because he has great boxing on the feet, he's got great power, but the southpaw look of Trinaldo seemed to give Herbert problems, and just the movement of Trinaldo on the feet seemed to give Herbert a little bit of trouble, because on the feet, yes, Herbert's really good, but guys who move really well on the outside, it sort of stifles his attack a little bit. He's almost a little bit more hesitant to just engage with guys who do have their great movement on the outside, because in the pocket, I think Jai Herbert can have like those 60-40 exchanges. I think he's a little bit better than a 50-50 guy, you know, like he'll catch a jiu-jitsu guy on the feet for the most part, but you know, Jai Herbert at his best is getting into some of those close range brawls. When he is fighting a guy, even, I guess not really all that relevant, but Cowboy Oliveira at his prime at lightweight, a guy who could move a lot, could switch stances on the outside, someone like that would give Jai Herbert problems. And I guess that's exactly what Trinaldo did. And then you look, okay, you lose to Trinaldo. Why are they making him fight Renato Moicano? Like, the matchmaking for Jai Herbert's just been very strange throughout his career. And honestly, this is the first fight that I'm like, okay, I'm good with the matchmaking on this, because Kama Worthy, like you said, needs a win. We know what the best version of Kama Worthy is. He's got good defensive submissions. He's got pretty good power on the feet. Yes, we worry about his durability, but at least Kama Worthy at his best can be a really fun fighter.
For Herbert, he rides this wave of success into the UFC just for it to crash down. For Kama Worthy, he rides a wave of something. I mean, listen, expectations for Worthy were pretty low. You're an old prospect, if you can even say that. You're a journeyman, some would say.
Because weight classes?
Listen, he had a loss to Paul Felder by knockout at lightweight in 2012. He had a knockout loss to Kyle Nelson at 145. Like, he had fought good competition. He had lost a good competition. So when I looked at that, I went, oh, okay, this guy's going to be whatever he is. And then he fights a guy who's a former teammate in Smith and finishes him and earns a performance bonus. And that was on a pay-per-view. And then if you look at it, his next fight, he beats a guy that a lot of people, you know, yikes, but Luis Pena, and he submits him. That's a big deal. That's a giant deal. So then if you look at it, he fights Otman Zaitsar, who, where are the potatoes, bud? And he gets knocked out. And then you go, okay, well, he wasn't durable at 145. What are we going to do in his next fight? He fights Jamie Mullerkey. And he gets caught by a punch and stanky-legged and loses all defenses. And then that's it. So when I look at Kama Worthy, great from long range, great defensive jiu-jitsu. When it's on the mat, period, he's a very, very formidable fighter. For Herbert, great boxing, outside, in tight, very fun guy to watch. He can give one to take one. maybe not against Francisco Trinaldo, but the same thing can be said for Kamal Worthy. I doubt he could take a clean shot from Trinaldo, Matt.
I know Francis Ngannou could.
I don't think I could, and we're going to find out this weekend who can. But Matt, when I look at this fight, there's so many question marks around it that I'd have a hard time being incredibly confident either way. I mean, Herbert excels against strikers. Worthy does sometimes. So that's the thing. The chins are the giant question mark. When I look at the odds for this one, Herbert opened a minus 105. It dropped, and now it's been fairly steady. He's minus 180 right now. For Worthy, he opened a minus 115. He's a plus 147. When we look at the Tapology votes, Matt, not that close. 759 of them, 66% Herbert, 84% by knockout. For the 34% that have Worthy, 71% by knockout. I have all sorts of notes on this fight, but the weirdest thing for me is the fact that Herbert, the fight against Masaranduba, goes on, goes on, goes on. He gets cold-cocked like he's not even paying attention. And then it's like, Herb, you got to stop this, right, man? No. And then in his last fight against Moicano,
goes on and on.
Goes
and on
into the second round. He gets submitted. For Worthy, he's had knockout loss in the past. Again, his first loss at, or his last loss at 155 by knockout was in 2012. So it's like, oh, okay, well, the durability's there at 155. And then his last two fights, he gets finished at 133 and then 46 seconds. Like, these are quick knockout losses. Both guys are heavy punchers, so you can chalk it up there. But, man, the durability's not good.
And that's why I don't have any notes on this fight. Like you said, I have a lot of notes on this fight. No matter what we say, it's going to end based on whoever lands the first punch. Kamal Worthy has good enough power to where I think he can knock out Jai Herbert with one clean shot. And I think Herbert has the good enough technique and good enough hand speed to do the same thing to Kamal Worthy. Because I do think Worthy has the slight power edge, although I do worry about his durability to the same degree. So both guys have crazy knockout power really in the matchup. But the thing about Herbert is that I think he might be able to catch Worthy on the inside. Worthy might be able to catch him on his way to the inside, though. And that's why I think I slightly edge Kamal Worthy in this fight. It's not like I think Worthy's going to go on some big rant or run by any means, but I haven't liked the Jai Herbert I've seen throughout these last two performances whatsoever. And if the fight does hit the mat, I'm slightly more confident in Worthy's ability than I am Jai Herbert's. Again, I don't think the winner of this fight is all of a sudden going to fix their career and then go on some big run, but I'm at least slightly more confident with what I know Kamal Worthy can do than the question marks I have surrounding Jai Herbert.
Shuffle, shuffle, L-step, Jai Herbert, your winner by knockout this weekend. I've got Herbert ever so slightly. But again, this is such a toss-up. I want to hear down below in the comments section, out there on the iTunes and the Spotify, when you're rating and reviewing, like I know you are, put it in the comments section. The boys told me, is it Herbert? Is it Worthy? We're split on the pick. I'm going with England's Jai Herbert. Matt's going with Pittsburgh's own Kamal Worthy. Matt, I can't wait for this fight because you know it's going to be fireworks. Oh, yeah. Regardless of who wins, should be a great one. Big time banger. I mean, we got the Black Country banger, but in the main event you have Paulo Costa taking on Marvin Vettori. I can't wait for it. So keep locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
Big time fight coming up at middleweight this weekend. You probably heard us talk about this if you're an avid Fight Night Picks fan. If you're not, well, good to see you. Hey, I'm looking forward to this one. We have Argentina's Laureano Staropoli taking on North Carolina's Jamie Pickett. The Night Wolf. Is it a good nickname? It's not that bad. It's not the worst I've ever heard. Rashad Coulter's Daywalker's the worst. Rashad, I want to hear from you, but also everybody that's tuning into this one down below in the comments section. Who do you have in this fight between a couple of dynamic guys? One guy's a middleweight. One guy's a bit of a transplant in Staropoli. And the other thing that I know, this fight was moved because it seems like there was a coach in Pickett's corner that tested positive for COVID or had a little bit of a COVID adjacent. So the fight was moved to our card coming up this weekend. We have a prediction video from a few weeks ago. We'll throw it on back to that, update the odds, and give you our final thoughts on this big one. We have the Night Wolf, Jamie Pickett. Taking on the Day Wolf. No, it's Pepe Laureano Staropoli. And Matt, when I look at this fight, it's a weird one because of where both of these guys are at. Normally, we save this until the end, but I'm going to mention the odds just to tell the story of this fight. Because for Argentina's fighter, Laureano, he opened a minus 150 favorite. He's a minus 213 right now. For Jamie Pickett, he opened a plus 130. He's a plus 172. And for Jamie Pickett, trains with a bevy of good fighters, Joe Selecki and John Salter among them. I thought Joe Selecki won on the weekend over Jared Gordon. But still, when I look at this fight, the question I ask is, why is Laureano Staropoli such a big favorite when he's lost his last three to Muslim Salikov, Tim Means, and Roman Dolidze? Good fighters. Don't get me wrong. All good fighters. Jamie Pickett losing two to Tafan Chukwe and Jordan Wright by knockout. And that knockout loss was about 4 months ago. Still relatively soon, I would think. And it was a quick one, too. But when I look at this fight, where's all this confidence in Laureano Staropoli, who kind of had his best times at 170 pounds?
That really is the strange thing about this fight. When I think about Staropoli, I think of him as a welterweight. I never really put him in the middleweight division because I thought he looked better at 170 pounds. I know he lost to Tim Means, and maybe I think way more about Tim Means than I should, but like, it's not the end of the world. You had a pretty good fight with him too, and the weird thing about Staropoli is, look at his fight with Roman Dolidze. You know what was a big issue in that fight? The size of Roman. It was a massive issue for him in that fight.
Well, Roman is exactly coming down from 205 to 185.
Yes, like Fergie famously sang about, they met halfway. The thing about Staropoli, though, was I thought that after you get out-muscled by a guy at 185 pounds and you have shown the ability to fight down at 170, you would then go back to the smaller weight class. It's kind of like Misha Cirkunov. If Misha Cirkunov ever fights at 185 pounds again, everybody around him should get fired tomorrow because he moved down in weight. His cardio looked bad. He didn't really, you know what I mean? Like, there was a lack of aggression, if you will. And I would say that you could point to the weight cut as a factor. With Staropoli, I think his size always is going to be a factor with him at 185 pounds. And unless he is able to just put such a crazy pace on these middleweights, I don't really know where all the success is going to come from at middleweight. And even with Jamie Pickett, like, Jamie Pickett's performance against Chukwe didn't look good at all. And then if you look at the Wright fight, like you said, it was over pretty quick, so you can't really take much from it. But I don't really love the fact that he is coming back so quick after such a flash knockout like that. Because I normally say, hey, 6 months is like the perfect test for past 6 months. Then you can come back after a knockout loss. I don't love the damage that Pickett has taken through his last two fights. I just don't really know what either guy is supposed to be doing in this division.
When you look at Jamie Pickett, he was on the first episode of Dana White's Tuesday Night Contender Series in 2017. He lost to Charles Byrd. He got finished in that one. Then he comes back in season 2019. I don't know what you want to call it.
How did that go, Craig?
Season 3, lost by decision to Punahele Soriano. That's going to happen. Then he comes back in season 2020, so that's season 4, and he knocks out Jonathan Pate with, as Dana White put it, a 22-punch combo. But it was insane. It really was insane. So then they match him up with Tafan Chukwe, a guy who had a win over William Knight, who won on Contender Series. And you looked at that fight and you went, well, why? And then the scores were 30-25 and 230-26s. That's not great.
No.
Then they give him Jordan Wright, who... we're talking out loud here. We're having fun. The guy knocks people out and he gets knocked out and he's fought guys with bad records and he lost to Joaquin Buckley. So there, let the chips fall where they may, but he knocks out Jamie Pickett. So I look at that. I worry about it a little bit. Looks like he's been training his jiu-jitsu a little bit. So that's great to see. But from Pickett, decent striking when he's outside and when he moves in, he has a lot of success. Or he gets hit with that shot. For Laureano Staropoli, out of the fights that he had, he was 7-1 coming into the UFC with all of his wins by finish. Then he won two decisions, one over Hector Aldana. That won him a fight of the night bonus. So that's pretty cool. You get to start it off pretty good. Then he beat Thiago Alves by decision. That's great. And then you look at it. They give him Muslim Salikov. Well, listen, maybe he didn't have the greatest, or he did have the greatest fight against Francisco Trinaldo. Muslim Salikov is one of the most classically trained, best strikers you're going to find out there at 170 pounds. The scores in that fight, Matt, 30-26, 30-26, 29-28. It was a 10-8 round two. Then he takes on Tim Means, 30-27, 29-28, 29-28. Okay, so he had one good round. Then, in his last fight, Roman Dolidze, all three 30-27s. And the problem in the Means fight and in the Dolidze fight, the pressure really caused Staropoli issues with the takedown attempts, but also just getting in close.
And I was going to say, it was very different types of pressure. And that's an important thing to say. It'd be different if it was just one thing has worked really well against him in the past. But you're 100% right. With Tim Means, he pressured with his volume, and then he mixed in his wrestling a little bit. With Dolidze, he was just all over you at all times with his footwork and then mixing in the wrestling. So, no, I think that's a really good point to mention when you do bring up the game of Staropoli, because he feels like one of those fighters who, when he's the one moving forward, he could have a ton ton of success, but when he's the one being pressured, I don't know if he's just always thinking about what has to come next when he is the one on the back foot, but there always seems to be a gap between the fighter in Staropoli who's moving forward and the guy who's moving backwards.
Jamie Pickett also has a giant reach advantage in this fight to go along with a slight advantage in height. He's the middleweight. To me, Staropoli had that one fight against Delice up at 185 pounds, but I know him as a welterweight. So the adjusted odds for this fight, we have Staropoli, who quite frankly is where he was a few weeks ago. He's minus 240. He's remained roughly there. For Pickett, somewhere around a plus 200. If we look at the Tapology picks for this one, 676 total votes, 77% Staropoli, 81% by decision. For the 23% that have Pickett, 54% by decision. I'm a little bit surprised by that amount of Staropoli voters getting him the win by decision, because for Pickett, durability has been a little bit of an issue. Staropoli, though, has been more of a welterweight that for some reason now finds himself at middleweight. But what we talked about a couple of weeks ago is the fact that for Staropoli, you look at the two losses, they're against really big middleweights. I mean, Roman Delice, and I guess I should say back at 170, the two losses, Tim Means, and then Muslim Salikov. I mean, Salikov's ranked right now. Well, Tim Means could fight ranked fighters
he's
and get
good.
Wins.
Yeah.
And Roman Delice, on his best day, when he's not talking to Eric Nixick and worrying about what, you know, he looks like in the cage, he's a really, really dangerous guy. So for Staropoli, just again, everything has to come into play. Everything he's done, you know, coming into the UFC, the Alves win, everything he did outside, he has to just bring it all together and fight a very clean and smart fight against a guy like Pickett.
So this is what I have to say. Since neither guy got COVID, it is hard for me to change my prediction. Like, we've done this a few times where someone's camp will get COVID and you know you gotta do the quick Instagram search. Okay, was it the fighter? Did they get hospitalized? Like, how serious was this? And now, luckily, for the most part, with a lot of MMA fighters, they might get it, might not feel good for a couple days, they come back in a few weeks, everything's good. Sometimes they're not, and that's what we have to kind of ask ourselves in these remakes. But since it was only Pickett's coach, it's not like I'm adding any more stock into the fact that, oh, now I think Pickett's going to lose even more than I originally did. But I still do like Staropoli in this. I don't love the fact that he is fighting at middleweight now. I did prefer him down at welterweight, but I don't think losing to a guy like Roman Delice means that, okay, now you're down to Jamie Pickett. He really only lost that fight to Delice because Roman is as big of a middleweight as you can possibly be. It just sort of wore on Staropoli as that fight went on. And I do like Laureano's staying power in this fight.
When I look at this fight and I look at blown up Gavin Tucker on the right-hand side of the screen here, I mean, I think he definitely has great opportunity in this fight. For the Nightwolf, you got to use that size. You got to use that physicality and his volume. We've seen him use his volume to win him fights. Look at the Jonathan Pate finish. As Dana White put it, what was it? A 22-punch combo is what he said. But I really do see this one as very close. And due to that, I see value in the underdog status of Pickett. I mean, Pickett had a hard time with the physicality and size of a guy like Tafan Chukwe, who probably a light heavyweight maybe. Like, really, I mean, when it comes down to it, now you're fighting a much smaller guy in Laureano Staropoli. And again, Jordan Wright has knockout ability. Staropoli definitely does, but at 185, I think it's that sweet spot. I think it's going to be a really tough fight. I like Jamie Pickett in this one ever so slightly because I see value in that underdog status. So both of us disagreeing on the pick. I have North Carolina's own Nightwolf Pickett to get the win here. Matt going with Argentina's Staropoli. Can't wait for this fight, though, because this should be a very dynamic one between a couple of guys who need a win at that. So can't wait for it. Let us know down below in the comment section who you have in this one, and stick around for that main event. Costa taking on Vittori. I'm popping popcorn in it up. I can't wait. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, and as we always say, let's get into it. And a welcome to the UFC, to Brazil's Maria Oliveira. Is it the Spider Girl? Is that the nickname that we're going with? She is going to be taking on somebody who's looking for a fresh start, back at her natural weight class, had the opportunity to debut against a future title challenger at 125 in Manoel Fiorito. I'm, of course, talking about Baby Shark, Tabitha Ricci and Matt. I absolutely am intrigued by this fight. And listen, I didn't say I love it. I said I'm intrigued by it because both of these women have contrasting backgrounds. For Ricci, black belt in jiu-jitsu, black belt in judo, national Muay Thai champion. And when we looked at Tabitha Ricci in our first go-through with her, because we don't have a rookie review for this fight, she took her debut on incredibly short notice. Manoel Fiorito was supposed to fight Marina Moroes at 125, and insert a small fighter that you're going to find at strawweight in Ricci. It was just a stupid mismatch to get her into the UFC. And in that fight, she struggled with the range. She struggled with the reach. She struggled with those front prodding kicks to the body. And ultimately, it was Fiorito earning a takedown in the second round. Ricci got right back up, and she just goes at her. Was it a great stoppage? I think it was, actually, because Ricci was just kind of covering up, turning away. It wasn't overall a great fight for Ricci. But the good thing is, at 155, through the poor competition, or sorry, at 115, against the poor competition that she's faced, she's been an absolute buzzsaw. And I know this is something that I talked about when we kind of did our question mark kicks debut. You look at how big of a favorite she was in her last two fights. She was more than a 2,500 favorite in her last win against Shauna Ormsby. Against Vanessa Grimes, she was a minus, 1,400 favorite or something like that. Like, it's just absolutely insane to see how big of a favorite she was with such a great background that she had. I understand why she lost her fight to start off her UFC career. I still think she is a very dynamic and exciting fighter back down at the weight class she belongs in.
I agree with everything you said. It's just so hard to defend it because she hasn't fought that high of a level of competition throughout her career. Like, I agree with you. I think her striking on paper is decent. I think her grappling is, of course, phenomenal. But when you actually look at her record and do the deep dive, it is really hard to say, well, that performance proves it. Well, who'd she really beat? Like, up until the Manal-Fiorito fight, and how many times do we say this about fighters, where it's like, okay, they might be 2-2 in the UFC, but their two losses are to fighters in the top 15, and their two wins are to fighters who are no longer in the organization. We've seen this time and time again, and that kind of applies to the whole career of Tabitha Ricci. Like, I really do like her grappling. I think she's phenomenal on the mat, and if you go back and just watch her grappling matches, like, she proves that in the gi, and even outside the gi, she has some no-gi grappling matches as well. She is really, really good on the mat. It's just in MMA, it's so hard to create some sort of a narrative to say, hey, Tabitha Ricci, because of these performances, is going to go on to have a really high ceiling. Now, the UFC is doing her a very big favor in this fight because they gave her about as hard of a debut as they possibly could against Manal-Fiorito up a weight class on short notice. This fight against Maria Oliveira is a much more winnable fight than her previous one was.
If you look at it for Ricci, she's somebody that trains in Southern California at some of the biggest gyms, and it's a litany of gyms. Like, we could only throw up one or two here for the graphics, but Knuckleheads, Blackhouse MMA, Paragon BJJ, Ruka Sport, like, she's training with some of the biggest and best minds in striking and grappling, really trying to put everything together. She's taking on Maria Oliveira, making her UFC debut. And this is one of the bigger head-scratchers of UFC signing that I've seen in such a long time. And if you look at her record, 12-4, that's awesome. That's great. Plenty of finish wins to boot. I look at the level of competition for her. Out of her 12 wins, 8-17 is what it is. The average, if you want to divide that out, it's 0.6 repeating wins to 1.416 repeating losses. It's very, very bad. She's getting into the UFC off a win over a debuting fighter. And if you go find that, find it. Find it really easy. She took on, and I want to make sure I get the name right, it was against Anila Tabosa. But it's Anila Emily, if you look it up on YouTube. They're fighting in a small gym, in a small cage. And again, it's just a fighter that has experience in a filled Ryzen Arena. In a Dana White's Contender Series spot against somebody who's making their debut. It was a huge mismatch. And listen, Anila lands a couple of shots in that one. But it is all Maria Oliveira. She ends up... this is the weird thing too. Tapology is the win one way. But if you go watch the fight, it's a knee to the body. And her opponent just loses her win and turns away and goes, no, I'm done. Which is weird. Because Maria Oliveira did that on Contender Series when she fought. And listen, that's where level of competition comes into play. Marina Rodriguez, it was like, yeah. I had to leave my family. My family doesn't want me to be here. I know I'm coming off a loss. I thought my career was done. Everybody kind of laughed me off when I was in Japan. I lost to Kana Asakura, who's a very good fighter. But she lost that fight in Ryzen to get a Dana White's Contender Series spot to lose to Marina Rodriguez. And in that fight, she did have a little bit of success in some of the blitzes. And then she gets hit, walks away, and goes, nope, I'm done. Like, it's so weird. It's she got beaten the striking in that fight against Asakura. She doesn't really have much success in the stand-up. She gets taken down, and that's where all is lost for Oliveira. She gets taken down. Now, again, this is years ago, but in that fight, she gets taken down, and she grabs onto any appendage she can to just try and force a stand-up. Because for Oliveira, great Muay Thai, one of the highest tie stances you're going to find. She's built like Matt Allen, and I mean that as no disservice to anybody.
Probably a great ball player.
Very, very, yeah, could probably throw really hard. Very long, very tall, very upright in her stance, and the Ryzen commentary were focusing on that, saying that she likes to model her style off of an Anderson Silva, prodding forward, really long stance. But for Maria Oliveira, again, giant question marks on that side too.
Maria Oliveira has a style that's kind of like a hydroelectric dam. Like, at range, and when it's at its best, it's doing a great job. It's keeping the water back, and it's keeping it where it's supposed to be. But the problem with any kind of dam is that once they do break, they end up underwater, and it's a really big catastrophe.
Normally the town ends up underwater.
But that's what happens to someone like Oliveira when they're at range, when you're one of these fighters who really relies on their distance management, but they're really bad when fighters get on the inside of that distance. Like, we see this all the time. Sabina Mazzau is a good example of it, where if everything's going well, and if you're not really dedicated to your game plan, and if there's no tenacity behind you, and if you're not really all that engaged too closing the distance on me, then I will have success. If you just allow me to strike at range, I'll be able to have some sort of success. And I think Oliveira is built kind of similarly. But the thing with Oliveira is that the second you put any kind of resistance against her, I don't want to say she gives up because that's questioning someone's character, but
I watched her give up in one fight.
But that's the thing. We've seen it in the past. And I don't want to say like Robin Black, but Craig and I were talking about this earlier this week. I listened to a podcast with Jerry West. And Jerry West, basketball player, I have a tremendous amount of respect
for
him.
He's in the logo.
He is. But what Jerry West is really known for is he's a great talent evaluator. He's a GM. He's an executive. And what he says is that every player who's going to get drafted has a really high skill level. They're all athletic. Like, you don't get to the NBA draft without being a great athlete. The real thing you have to look for is, what does the person have on the inside? Like, do they really want to be great every day they wake up? Or are they just happy to be in the mix? I don't think Maria Oliveira wakes up every day and she's like, hey, I'm going to be UFC champion. I think Tabitha Ricci just had a really tough out in her UFC debut, but I still think that there's a solid foundation there for a fighter to make a run. Now, if you want to come at me on Twitter and say, oh, who is Tabitha Ricci beat? Then yeah, I can't really argue against it, but at least her credentials outside of the cage, They mean something to me. And I do think that that experience is important. And that's why I think she's going to be able to get this win.
So I look at the odds for this one. Ricci open a minus 180. She's minus 225 right now. Oliveira open a plus 155. She's a plus 181. If we have a look at the Tapology votes for this one, 754 total votes, 83% Ricci, 51 by decision, 41% by submission for the 17% that have Oliveira, 75% by decision. All right. We've been negative on Oliveira. Let's turn this one into a positive. If you look at it, a lot of Muay Thai fighters can have success against pure grapplers. You saw that in a main event 2 weeks ago. You had Marina Rodriguez, who one of these fighters has fought, with her great Thai stance, with her great striking, great defense in terms of her takedown defense, and I struggled with that. But for Maria Oliveira, again, the blueprint's right there. And for Tabitha Ricci, just how good can her takedowns be? Because for her, and I had this in my notes, this, like, there's a full page on this one, ladies and gentlemen, and everybody out there. But when I look at this one, she strikes the clinch to get the takedown to not get position. It's takedown to try and do whatever I can on the ground. It's not position over submission. It's, I get you down, I'm having, like, we're in the Peter Barrett zone of Slippery's world, if I can make a really obscure MMA reference to a featherweight of a not-so-bygone era. But when I look at this one, Matt, Oliveira's got to keep it standing. She's got to work her great Thai boxing, and she is a very good striker. Throws a nice leg kick, throws a nice volume, and can really stifle her offense. This really comes down to who can move forward quickest and who's able to establish that pressure. Fiorot was able to do it against Ricci. Oliveira could do it against Ricci. If not, it's Ricci breaking in, taking it down, and taking something home to get a win.
I don't think there's going to be a crazy level of volume on the feet between these two fighters, and I'm really only confident in my prediction throughout this fight, saying Tabitha Ricci's the better grappler between the two. So to me, it's like, okay, on the feet, Oliveira's probably better, don't get me wrong, but Oliveira doesn't have crazy knockout power or anything that I think she could just go out there and take on Tabitha Ricci, overwhelm her with a few strikes, and then finish her quickly after that. So I think she's going to be a little bit hesitant when she does move forward, because she understands, if I really do let my hands go, that's when Ricci's going to go after my hips, try to take me down, and then just try to to out-grapple me. So I think Oliveira is going to be a little bit hesitant on the feet because of the threat of the takedowns there from Ricci. And I do think that if Ricci can get one takedown, she will be at least able to hold that position. I'm not going to say, oh, Ricci's going to get the submission, because I thought if Mackenzie Dern took down Marina Rodriguez, she'd be able to get the submission immediately. And that didn't end up all that well for her. She came very close. That's the thing. Mackenzie Dern has that kind of jiu-jitsu. You really have to worry about it. I don't know if Ricci's on that level, but I do think she's going to be able to out-grapple the majority of fighters in the strawweight division.
Ricci coming in, Matt made a comparison, and I have to kind of pick on you a little bit. You said this, and this is a direct quote from Kicks when we previewed her fight with Fyodo. You said, losing this fight could be the best thing for Ricci against Fyodo. Losing it, that could be the best thing. Your big comparison, and you threw it out there, was the fact that she has those kind of credentials like somebody like a Stephanie Egger, and she's bringing it together. Egger was able to do that in her last fight against Shannon Young. She threw everything that she had in her back pocket, all of those credentials, boom goes the dynamite. So, can the jiu-jitsu play
Wait, have I contradicted that point at all yet?
No, but you were really against Egger taking on Young. That's the one real contradiction. Oh, but when I look at this one, it's everything that Ricci has. Can she bring it together? It's Oliveira. Can I use the takedown defense? Can I use everything I have? Because for her to get back into the sport and to get motivated into it, it took a little bit of coaxing from Jessica Andrade, who she trains with. So a lot of great training partners for Oliveira in Brazil at her gym. For me, I'm going Ricci ever so slightly. But again, the odds scare me away. Like, 2-1 odds on relative unknown commodities in terms of, you look at the level of competition they faced and it's paltry compared to some of the other contemporaries in a very stacked division. I've got Ricci, definitely no bet.
I've got Ricci, but I don't think either one of these fighters have like a rankings type of a ceiling. I don't. I think Ricci can have fun fights against people coming off Contender Series, for instance. I think she can stay in the UFC for a little while, but I don't think Ricci's going to win this fight then all of a sudden go on a run of strawweight.
Hey, I would love to hear the opinions of everybody out there. Do you have Oliveira in this fight? Are you going with Ricci? We both have a Ricci to get the win, but Matt, big time fights coming up this weekend. Big time main event feels with Costa taking on Marvin Vettori. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Low-key, I absolutely love this fight. Coming up this weekend at 185 pounds, we have the Iron Turtle, Jun Young Park, taking on RoboCop Gregory Rodriguez, a guy who came to the States to help his friends build a church. Good, you don't believe him. Me? Look that stuff up. It's absolutely insane. He's had a wild MMA career that spanned, you know, a little bit of training in California, moved his camp over to Sanford MMA, comes into the UFC, the rest is history. Now, I have to get this out of the way quick, because for me, Jun Young Park is like opening a stocking on Christmas morning going, ah, socks? Or going, ah, a navel orange. I didn't want this. But then I really sit back and, you know, you get books. In my case, you get different things to add to the display behind you.
I was going
to
say, Craig, don't say
and
that
then
like you read.
You circle on back to the socks and you put them on and you're like, you know what? I like these socks. And then you're a year down the road and you forget about the stuff in the display and you're still wearing those socks going, gosh darn it, that was pretty good. And then to circle back on the orange, it's like, hey, that was a tasty treat. I'm not getting scurvy now. When I look at Jun Young Park, his debut against Anthony Fluffy Hernandez, I look at, and I'm dead serious when I say this because we've had these missteps before. Everybody has them. I'll admit when I'm wrong. It's like when Jonathan Pierce fought Joe Lozon. How much stock can you put into a loss to Fluffy Hernandez? Because, I mean, listen, he's the black belt hunter at this point. And I look at that fight that he had against Hernandez as a giant blip in the radar, an opportunity for him to fix holes in his games. And this is where I have the proof to back it up. He got taken down 6 times by Hernandez in that fight, ultimately submitted. Then he fights Marc-Andre Barrio, goes 5 of 10 for his takedown attempts against a power bar that has good takedown defense. He goes 4 for 4 against John Phillips. All 3 of the judges scored that fight, 30-25 for Park. Then he takes on Tafon Chukwe, goes 2 of 5, and owns him and dominates him on the ground. So for me, Jun Young Park is not just a very good boxer, not just a guy that can move forward, that can eat and give and receive. He's a guy that can continue to improve his game. I remember talking about it before his last fight against Chukwe, where I picked Chukwe to win that fight. I said he's training with, who is it, Donggi Yang, the Ox. And I went, wow, that's a giant plus for a guy like Jun Young Park. And then I picked Chukwe anyway. I was so wrong to do that. So I want to give this guy his flowers. I absolutely love watching Jun Young Park fight. And I have to say the same thing for Rodriguez, who I watch his fight when he takes on Jordan Williams. I discount it. And then I look at everything he's done since and I go, wow, this guy's turned it around too. So I can't put as much stock into losses like that. Sometimes it's hard and sometimes you need to, but these guys have proven me wrong now time and again, and I absolutely love their fight styles.
I think this fight's going to be phenomenal. There's few unranked middleweight rematches that I feel like need to happen. Fluffy Hernandez versus Junyun Park would be a great rematch to make in the future if either guy ever gets in the rankings. Like, that might not be a main event fight night card, but that's definitely a co-main event slot.
Before we go too far and we talk about Gregory Rodriguez, this is a great opportunity. Let's run on back to a 15-minute card breaks rookie review because we had so many things to say before his fight against Dusko. Let's give it back to the rookie review. Big time banger coming up this weekend at 185 pounds, replacing Maki Patolo. We have Gregory Rodriguez, and man, is he coming in at a good time. I like this fight almost more than the original booking, taking on Dusko Todorovic. And Matt, holy smokes. I mean, for Gregory Rodriguez, you look at it, and this is a guy that a lot of people probably counted out. His last loss was on Contender Series. He got finished by Jordan Williams, who punched his ticket to the UFC. So what does Rodriguez do? He doesn't sit there and slouch. He goes back to LFA. And a little bit over a month and a half ago, almost 2 months ago, he fights Al Matavao. And you might go, Craig, well, you've talked some smack about Al Matavao here in the past. And yes, I have. But he finished him. That's a decent win. You finish a guy like that, that's great. And then on short notice, he fights Josh Fremd over with LFA for the middleweight belt, and it was vacant. But think of all the great middleweights they've had in LFA that have held that belt. Brennan Allen being one
Eric
of them.
Eric Anders
being another one. So many great. Marcus Perez, another one. Like, we could go on all day. No,
he was at welterweight.
We could go on forever. But for Rodriguez, RoboCop, he's coming in here with head of steam. Again, that fight that he took. Now, listen, it wasn't 2 days and 16 hours ago, but yeah, it was just last weekend. So now he's going to fight again this week, taking on Dusko. I mean, holy smokes, it's a tough fight, but if anybody can do it, maybe it's him.
If we're really going to give Gregory Rodriguez his flowers, he does have really good power in his hands and with both hands, too. He's good from the orthodox and from the southpaw, or at least he has good power from both sides. And when you're fighting a guy like Dusko, who, yes, I think Dusko is the more well-rounded guy on the feet. I think he's the more, I should say, polished striker out of these two. But the fact that Dusko has such a big issue with his defense on the feet, he's going to give a lot of guys who maybe technically aren't on his level a chance to beat him every time he steps in.
And against Rodriguez, you not only have to worry about the striking, but the jiu-jitsu. And this is a guy, again, he was a plus 190 underdog in that fight on May 21st. Matt, we're filming this, and we're
kind
what?
Kind of wild.
We're what, the 28th?
7?
No, we're the 31st. So, okay. Tapology has their dates wrong, but really, it is a quick turnaround for the man representing Brazil, coming out of Sanford MMA. And I watched an interview, and this was an interesting one. Do it if you have the chance over on Facebook with Gabriel Gonzalez, MMA Uncaged. The reason why Rodriguez came to the States was because his friends from Brazil wanted to open a church and they needed help. So he's like, yeah, okay, I'll help you out. Then he started training at King's MMA, got to work in with Cordero. Then he went to Florida and boom, like Bob's your uncle. It's kind of crazy to hear that story. So I'm going to let you take over. When Gregory fought Dusko, you look at the scores for that one. 230-27s, you had 129-28. I mean, round three, what? Like, probably didn't win that one, but he went off to such a fast start. He threw off Dusko's total game. It was a great performance. And again, high ceilings for both guys.
I agree 100%. The winner of this fight isn't going to get a ranked opponent next, but if they got one more win, I'd say, then maybe they're on that borderline. Because I was going to bring up just other unranked middleweights. Like, Brennan Allen's a guy who could probably face the winner of this fight. I really do feel like, Rodriguez and Park are both in that, like, we're only one fight away category.
The winner of Ian Heinisch and Sam Alvey. You know, right?
A fight that doesn't need to happen, but for some reason is. It gives you the idea as to what the ceilings, just sort of the overall landscape of Park and Rodriguez is in the division. Because I truly believe that both guys on their best day could probably offer a difficult fight to that lower end of the rankings right now. Especially Park with his overall durability and his wrestling. Because if you want to beat a guy like Junyoung Park, you almost have to look at Marvin Vettori's losses and try to like work your way back from there. Because Park does have a slight Marvin Vettori scariness to his game. And that's one of the first fighters I think of. If Perk is able to figure it out, because Mervatory for a long time was a fighter who had a lot of hype, had good wrestling, had good cardio, but he just lacks sort of the X factors and the intangibles to bring everything together. And I can feel people getting upset right now. Chunyun Park, he's not Mervatory. Stop right now. But I do think Park has a game where if he is able to start bringing in the striking defense a little bit more, he could go on a Mervatory-like run. Let's say they give him Kevin Holland next. I think he could beat Kevin Holland.
Mervatory doesn't have a win over Glenn Sparv. Mervatory doesn't have a win over Ray Cooper III. Like, these are things that Chunyun Park has. They're tangible. Not really. Records aren't tangible. I mean, unless you got, like, Half Moon Run, a blemish in the great light. But when you look at this fight, again, two very dynamic guys with very contrasting styles.
Oh, 100%. Now, with Rodriguez, I think he's going to have a little bit more success on the feet at range. But the weird thing is that if he does end up throwing too many kicks, they're going to result in him getting taken down a lot. If you look at what Park was able to do against Chukwe, it's not just that his wrestling was great. And you bring up the numbers, he only went, yeah, like what, 2 for 5? It wasn't like he used a crazy amount of volume to go out there and get his takedowns. But what he did do, he timed the strikes of Chukwe phenomenally. He waited until Chukwe was finally starting to unload blitz forward, and that's when he decided, hey, I'm going for your hips now. And it will be really interesting because Rodriguez, where he's going to have his most success at that range, is where he will be susceptible to some of those takedowns from Park. So this is going to be one of those really close fights. And like you had said for, what was it, the Jeff Molina, Daniel Lacerda fight, you hate to say this could be a split decision, but I can see a world where Rodriguez gets off to a great start. He's got a great level of volume, and just really his strikes are able to catch Park from so far away that Park isn't able to mix in his strikes with his wrestling at all in the first round. But it could be one of those fights where as Rodriguez starts to tire as this fight goes on, I could see Park slowly starting to bring his way back into the fight. It's really just going to matter when does the cardio factor play a part. Because if Park can start to take over and really implement his wrestling in, let's say, the latter stage of the first round. Let's say he gets a takedown with 10 seconds left in the first round, loses that round, but at least inspires a little bit of confidence moving forward. Then maybe Park could go out there, use that grinding game plan, and win the second and third round. But if Rodriguez is able to land a lot of leg kicks early and just take away some of the explosiveness of Park's takedown attempts, then I think Rodriguez could have, I don't want to say an easy fight because no fight's ever easy, but I definitely could see him fighting one of those fights where it's at range and Park's just never really able to close that distance.
And Rodriguez has ungodly power. It's absolutely insane. And you see that with the level of finishes that he has on his record, a guy that's had a great streak lately, both guys 4-1 in their last 5. When you look at the odds for this one, Park opened a decent favorite, minus 170. You can now see him in and around the, minus 110 mark. Same thing for Rodriguez. Opened up a plus 145, minus 110. So pick 'em odds for this one. If we have a look at the votes, I'm going to assume here, Matt, we're going to play a little game. I'm going to say 70% Park.
That's what I was thinking. Yeah, I agree.
Look at that. I mean, 801 total votes, 65% Park. What is it? 86% by decision for the 35% that have Rodriguez. Again, 48% decision, 39% by knockout, a slim margin having to win by submission. I see this as a very close fight. The odds would tell you that. The fan votes, I think, still tell you that. Again, I like what Chunyun Park's been doing, and I know I've talked about him a lot more than I have Rodriguez, insert the old rookie review, but I do like Park's overall game in this one. I think it's one of those ones that just kind of stymies all of the giant, you know, kind of X factors, those superstar Madden kind of things that Rodriguez has. I see this one as another win for South Korea's Park.
The thing that worries me, now I do agree, my official prediction will be Chunyun Park. But he does tend to eat some power shots on his way in. Yes, he has good timing when he does decide to shoot, but every now and then he can get caught because it's kind of like he's analyzing it in his mind, okay? Just imagine yourself in the cage. You're thinking, okay, when's the perfect time to go for a takedown? When you're constantly thinking about it, sometimes you are going to get caught. Guys are fast. They're in the UFC. And I do worry about him fighting a guy like Rodriguez, who does have that genuine one-punch power, because this could be one of those fights where it is. Like, Park's looking great until he doesn't. He eats that one big shot and things go south immediately for him. But until he does eat that big shot, I do think momentum will be in Park's favor, and that's why I like him in this
fight. And if this goes to the ground, I mean, even on the way down, you have great defensive submissions. You have anaconda chokes from Chunyun Park. You've got some great moves by Rodriguez, too. I want to hear from everybody down below in the comments section. Who do you have for this one? Both of us going with South Korea's Chunyun Park to get the win, Matt. Absolutely love the card. Great prospects. A lot of fighters you know and love that have been around for a long time. Hey, I'm looking at you, Alex Caceres and Sung Woo Choi. And in our main event, we have Paulo Costa making the return, taking on Marvin Vettori. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Coming up this weekend at 205 pounds, this straight up feels like a giant stepping stone of a fight. We have Romania's Nicolae Negru-Mariano taking on Hurricane Ike Villanueva. It feels like going from a slice of cheese to like a wax-wrapped amber mist from the Stodonia Cheese Company. Now, Matt, straight up, listen, a little bit of inside baseball. Do I buy my Christmas cheese on sale in October? Yeah, I do. You can get great deals. It's a great time to buy cheese. But what I do know is the fact that this is just weird matchmaking, and I look at it in a couple of different ways. Ike Villanueva, puncher's chance in every single fight that he's in. He's a very interesting boxer. You've seen it at 265. You've seen it at 205. He was a great champion over with Fury before he came into the UFC. And that's an organization that's really been making a lot of noise with some big names. But when you look at Villanueva, he was coming off of wins over, who was it, Roger Narvaez and Rashad Coulter, the Daywalker, best nickname in sports. And then in the UFC, lost to Chase Sherman, lost to Jordan Wright, beats Vinicius Moheo, one of the more questionable UFC fighters we've ever seen. And then he gets knocked out by Marcin Prachniak. So for Villanueva, he has one win over a guy that was bad in the UFC and three knockout losses. Bad stuff. Nicolae Negru-Mariano, I can really point to a lot of weird things. First thing, he's from the Transylvania region of Romania. That probably gets a lot of, volume in terms of the medias, social and otherwise, online this time of year. His UFC fights, he loses Saperbeg Safarov on incredibly short notice in his UFC debut. He beats Alexa Kammer by split decision his last time out. You'd think those are all cut and dry. They are not. Negru-Mariano is a guy that had a lot of success at 265 pounds before he made moves and started grooves before they knew we were gone. That's my one OMC reference for this weekend. The Otara Millionaires Club. I'd like to know more. Want to know the rest? Hey, buy the rights. Matt, but he came in on short notice against Safarov and he got out-wrestled by the Sambo champ. So it didn't go well for him, but again, I can chalk that one up to jitters. I can make a lot of excuses. Negru-Mariano took a long time off between fights. He comes back and fights Kammer. Matt, the overall scores for that fight, MMA decisions had it. 30-27, Negru-Mariano, two of them. 11-29-28, Negru-Mariano. 1-29-28, Alexa Kammer. So again, I'd say it was a close split decision. When I watched it,
yeah, it was a close fight. Let's not act like he just ran over.
It was a close enough fight where Negru-Mariano had a little bit of success on the ground. But let's say this. In a perfect world, Ike Villanueva goes out and he fights his fight. He's looking like the Bucks playing for the title. He's on. He's going out there, marching guys down, throwing the hooks, knocking guys out cold. Big Ike Villanueva win. When Nick Negru-Mariano's on, he's looking like a Vitaly Minnikov on every single USADA banned substance. He's going out there flipping guys. He's knocking them out. He's having a ton of fun. So when I start this one off comparing expensive cheese that I buy on sale really early
to cheese
slices. Well, I'm a weird guy. To cheese slices.
I know.
That's why it feels like such a weird stepping stone where you go with a guy that's been knocked out in three of his last four fights to a guy who, again, on his best day, Negru-Mariano has a decently high ceiling.
That's where I might disagree with you a little
You're
bit.
You're Lozon in the Joe. I'm not.
I'm not. But when you get out grappled by a guy like Saperbeg Safarov, it does make me a little bit concerned when you yourself are a grappler. When you, at your peak, is throwing guys through the air. When you are that dominant physical kind of a grappler, I do have concerns when you yourself get out grappled. And I think those are fair to have. It's not like Saperbeg Safarov is like a great UFC fighter who on short notice you were forced to fight. Saperbeg Safarov's been finished by everybody, and that's what concerns me a little
bit. Safarov was getting ready for a fight against now re-signed glory kickboxer Gokhan Saki.
And that tells you the kind of fighter Safarov is. Now, that's why I was really concerned with that loss from Negru-Mariano. And I'm glad you brought it up, or at least brought up the scoring of the Kammer fight, because it was a split decision. I had a 29-28 Negru-Mariano. I thought he was at least physical enough, and like you had said, he really did implement his grappling at some point throughout that fight. But my big thing about Ike Villanueva is that he's kind of your mom's idea of a heavyweight. You know? Like, He throws wild bombs.
Matt, this one's at light heavyweight.
Sorry, I know, but still, he fought at heavyweight. He's light heavyweight as well. But he's got that, like, big power. He throws wild shots in the feet. You know the grappling's a bit of a question mark, but he's going to have a fun fight no matter what. And that's why Ike Villanueva, his record doesn't really matter. That's why he's been able to stay around for as long as he has in the UFC. Like, we might joke, what is he, 18 and 12? It's not a great record, but it's not like those fights are boring. None of them have been. Ike Villanueva is always willing to eat a shot to give a shot. It's just at the UFC and at this level, a style like that doesn't get you into the rankings. A style like that doesn't get you into main event slots. And I'm not saying Nigel Mariano has that kind of a destiny. I think he can be a 10 to 15 guy probably on his best day. I do worry about him up against those, like, top 10 guys, and honestly, even him cracking the rankings is probably wishful thinking on my behalf. It's just, for Ike Villanueva, unless he has that one big shot where he lands, like, off of something that his opponent does really poorly, kind of like Vinicius Mojea. Like, in that fight, Vinicius goes to wind up the biggest right hand you've ever seen. He throws, like, a Marge Simpson uppercut, and Ike Villanueva throws one punch up the middle, catches him on the way in, and absolutely flatlines him. So, like, it wasn't that Ike Villanueva went out there and destroyed him. It's that he capitalized on a big mistake from his opponent. I think that unless Nigel Mariano decides to make a massive mistake like that, he should be able to win this fight, because he has a much more well-rounded mixed martial artist.
Canyonero. If you look at it for Nigel Mariano, the level of competition he took into the UFC was absolutely appalling. And I have the number in front of me, so let's do it. So he's got 10 wins, and that's cool. Level of competition, 37 and 81. And I mentioned it, the Hatep Moeli fight continues to look good, and I still agree with that, but it's a weird fight. The odds for this one, if you like Nikolai Negomariani, we open to minus 300. He's minus 233 right now. Ike Villanueva open to plus 250. He's a plus 186. If I had to guess on the Tapology votes, I'm going to say 85% Negomariani.
I'll say slightly under.
91% wow. Of 810 total votes are for Nikolai Negomariano. That's 66% by knockout. For the 9% that have Villanueva, 81% by knockout. Matt, I don't feel like I did when Bruno Silva fought Andrew Sanchez. And man, you talk about some nervous moments at the Moncton Coliseum watching that one. But I think that, listen, our cheese slice are going to level up to expensive cheese. I've got Nigel Mariano here to bring the win back to Transylvania.
Never do the Tito Ortiz, like, juice box crush again, because that's basically what you just did right
the
now.
The big reveal.
Yeah. I think Nigel Mariano is going to win. Just, again, Ike Villanueva can have fun fights, but it's hard to point at entertainment value and point to wins coming from it. Like, I really do like watching Ike Villanueva. I get excited for his fights. They're normally going to end in a finish. You just don't really know who's going to get finished. I do like Nigel Mariano, though, in this one.
Both of us going with Romania's Nikolai Nigel Mariano. If you like cheese slices, slide in my DMs because I like them. We had a big time fight coming up this weekend in the main event. Costa taking on Vittori. I can't wait for it. Speaking for both of us, I think we're really excited. Let's keep locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
I hate cheese slices.
Tune into Bellator when I crush Chael Sonnen. Okay, Craig. Wow.
Big time fight coming up this weekend at welterweight. We have one that I'm sure Phil Collins and the boys with Genesis would have a lot of fun with, because it's just going to be a matter of time before we get that invisible touch. And Father Time taps one of these guys in the back. But we have Massaranduba, Francisco Trinaldo, who I just sounded like a mom in Connecticut trying to say his nickname. Yeah. Massaranduba. It's Massaranduba, Francisco Trinaldo. He's taking on one of my favorite action fighters to watch when he's on, in Dwight the Body Snatcher Grant. St. John, New Brunswick's own Donald Sutherland was in that movie. A lot of fun. We're having fun here, Matt. When I look at this fight, and when we learn a lot of things, it's the fact that these guys have had very interesting careers after 35. For Trinaldo, he was a guy kind of knocking on the rankings at lightweight for the longest time. I think he beat Alexander Hernandez, loses a fight, moves up to 170. And listen, that's where it gets weird, because, I mean, you look at the fight that he had his last time out. It was against
Muslim Salik.
Well, it must have been somebody good. Now, hold on just a second, because I made a mistake. No, he didn't lose at 155.
What are you?
That's the weirdest thing. He moved up from 155 after he missed weight and fought Jai Herbert. And listen, you don't like to see it when somebody misses weight, especially late in their career. But they didn't do him any favors, and they gave Muslim Salikov. And normally, when it's a Trinaldo fight, he's pressuring forward. He's throwing good volume. And in the fight against Salikov, he moved forward, and he got countered a lot. Muslim Salikov, listen, Wushu Sanda world champion, won an appendage of the 2008 Beijing Olympics, won a gold medal there. Like, the guy is an accredited striker as it gets. And in that fight, Trinaldo just didn't have any success, got 3x30-27 in that one.
He didn't have no success. The rounds were all pretty close, and that's the thing about that fight. Like, yeah, Muslim Salikov won, and I thought he was gonna knock Trinaldo out. But that fight's way closer than you've set it up. Like, Trinaldo did march forward. He didn't get knocked out by a guy who's got way more power, who's a much bigger fighter than him. Like, I think there were some positives to draw from that performance, especially when you're trying to look forward, because I think Muslim Salikov is a much more dynamic striker than Dwight Grant. He throws a lot more kicks than Dwight Grant does, so you can kind of eliminate that whole part out of his game. And he's got probably the same level of power Dwight Grant does too, and he wasn't even able to put Trinaldo down. That's why I think you're discrediting Trinaldo at 170 a little bit too much. Like, I don't think the fight against Muslim Salikov is a performance you can look to and say, oh, he lost to Salikov, so now I just don't think this is the weight class for him. I think Trinaldo could have fun fights with some guys at this weight class. Like, I think Trinaldo is able to get the win tonight, or not tonight, sorry, if he's able to get the win this weekend, like, Kevin Lee's probably a good opponent for him. Like, these are the guys I'd like to see Trinaldo in there with, because I don't think he's someone who can get into the rankings at 170 pounds, but I do think his speed and just his sort of craftiness on the outside is going to be good enough to beat some guys at 170. I just don't think it was good enough to beat a guy like Salikov, who is so comfortable waiting on the back foot, where not many guys are in this weight class. Like, I think Salikov can deal with pressure a lot better than a lot of guys can, and that's what he did in the fight against Trinaldo. But I do think that the skills Trinaldo showed in that performance are translatable, I guess, other guys in this weight class, and I do think that they're translatable against a guy like Dwight Grant.
Matt's pick is Trinaldo. My pick...
No, it's not. I think Dwight Grant's going to win, but I don't think we can just look at the Muslim Salikov fight and say Trinaldo has no chance whatsoever.
Matt going out there tonight, and putting everybody in a land of confusion. Matt, this is the weirdest part. When I look at it for Dwight Grant, he has a win on his record in his last fight. He fought Stefan Sekulic, a guy who had been away forever. Like, he was a guy like Nikolai Negomariano, where it was like, okay, you lost your debut. What have you done? And for Sekulic, kind of turned it on. And in that fight, I actually, you can go back, you can find me at Craig Allen on Twitter. I scored at 29-28 Grant. Most people didn't score it that way. People got mad at me in the Twitter mentions. And if you look at it, MMA decision, 6 had it, 29-28 Grant. 9 had it, 29-28 Sekulic. 1 had it, 29-27 Sekulic. 1 had it, or sorry, 2 had it, 30-27 Sekulic. 1 had it, 30-26 for Sekulic. The reason that I scored it for Grant and I disagreed with the commentary in that fight was because Sekulic had the takedowns, and that's what a lot of people thought won it for him. To me, he didn't do a lot with the takedowns, and Dwight Grant was more effective on the feet. So even if we throw that fight out and we look at the recent run, Grant almost finished Daniel Rodriguez. Wartione said no. Rodriguez gets back into it, knocks out Dwight Grant. Before that, he's getting out volume by Carlo Pedersoli. Pedersoli comes in, knocks him out. And then in the fight against Alan Joban, he wins by split decision. A tricky fight that could go either way.
One of the worst fights ever.
Yeah, it's not really a great one. So when I look at this one in terms of matchmaking, the weirdest part about it is you talk about the rankings and guys having fun fights. You have to almost think that the UFC considers this relatively close to the rankings, considering Grant's coming off a win, Trinaldo's coming off a loss to a ranked guy.
I don't think the UFC thinks either one of these guys are getting in the rankings. I gotta be completely honest. Like, Dwight Grant, this is the thing that people forget. Yes, his highlights look great, but watch the performances up until those highlights.
Zach Otto.
He doesn't have good volume at all. Like, he gets out volume by most average strikers on the feet who have a decent pace, and he really needs to set up his knockout shots. I know he caught Daniel Rodriguez with a crazy, like, looping hook, but for the most part, that's not Dwight Grant's game. For the most part, it's you leave yourself open doing something crazy, and then he'll catch you. But other than him catching you in those windows, like, I don't think Dwight Grant's this crazy good striker on the back foot. I don't think he's someone who can go out there and push a pace on guys at 170. Like, if he fought Santiago Ponzinibbio is not currently in the rankings right now, and if we're going to talk about welterweights who aren't in the rankings but who are close, I think Ponzinibbio would blow the doors off a guy like Dwight Grant just because his overall pace is so high. And when you do look at Dwight Grant, this is why I'm bringing up all the Trinaldo, like, Muslim Salikov stuff. You were thinking I was trying to set this up to pick Trinaldo, but not at all. Trinaldo pressured Salikov that whole entire fight. The difference between Dwight Grant and Muslim Salikov is that Salikov can keep his composure when he's moving backwards, throw with volume, and then use his footwork to move. Dwight Grant can't use his footwork and strike at the same time because he plants his feet and then throws. And the problem with the guy who plants his feet and throws is when you land, yeah, that's great, but when you miss, you are way out of position. And I know Trinaldo's 43 years old, but he's got way more pop in his shots than most 43-year-olds. He's like David Ortiz his last season. He was 42, 43?
He was just 40.
Okay, but he was a guy in his 40s.
Allegedly.
Who was supposedly way past his prime, who was able to show that, like, hey, I've still got pop. Now, I understand baseball power much different than MMA power, but I do think that what Ronaldo showed in that Muslim-Salikov fight at least sets up somewhat of a game plan for there to be a world where he beats Dwight Grant. Now, I think he's going to eat a shot and probably go down because he is 43, and I don't think he need the power that a lot of guys at 170 can display, but I don't think you can just look at the scores of the Salikov fight, look at Dwight Grant as being a primary striker, and say, oh, Dwight Grant's going to win just based off that.
No, because the guy's a wushu world champion and an almost gold
medal. I know, but you would just said, oh, he 30-27 him, so he's going to beat him.
Yeah, no, the point is, it wasn't that close of a fight. Yeah, Trinaldo landed some decent shots, but he got way out-volumed against a good fighter who's now in the rankings. So it's really, really tricky when you try and dissect it. If you want to focus on the giant positives, it's the fact that a 40-something was able to continue to win against Bobby Green, John McDessie, and Dry Herbert.
I thought he beat James Vick, too, back in the day.
And not Muslim Salikov. For Grant, the level of competition hasn't been there as much, but definitely has that pop on a shot. So when I look at the odds for this one, a little bit of a surprise to me. Grant opened the underdog plus 140s, plus 101 or thereabouts right now. For Trinaldo, open to minus 160. He's a minus 125. I mean, when you're trying to make a pick for this one, it feels like you're throwing it all away. It feels like the last song on side two. Maybe you go with, I'm not joking, the Brazilian. But Matt, it is a really tricky fight when it all comes down to it.
It is.
Parlay buster.
Yeah, don't put money on this fight. These are two borderline 40-year-olds fighting each other in a cage. I like the overall game of Dwight Grant. But again, this is, okay, I'm going to say this. This is the Andrew Sanchez, Bruno Silva of this card. Craig doesn't think Trinaldo has any chance like he thought Andrew Sanchez, but I'm here to tell you, I really do think Trinaldo is like, he's right there in this fight. I really do think this fight's a lot closer than people think. People look at his age, they look at the fact that he used to be a lightweight, and people discredit him at this weight class, but I really do think that the skills he has are somewhat weaknesses for Dwight Grant. Like, Trinaldo can strike moving forward. He is evasive on the outside. Those are things Dwight Grant struggles with, and I could see this could be one of those fights where Trinaldo wins the first round, looks really good in the second round, but then ends up getting caught by a clean shot. So I'm going to pick Dwight Grant, but I can see there being a world where Trinaldo wins.
Yeah, I've got Francisco Trinaldo in this fight because I think that brooding pressure is something that Dwight Grant really struggles with. Now, he has the kung fu in his back pocket. He's got a decent jiu-jitsu pedigree. I think Master Andub was one of those guys that when he's smaller, gets his head right in that chest and doesn't go away. He's one of those guys that can accumulate time. And that is a real, real struggle. And we saw that Sekulic was able to do it against Grant.
Trinaldo's
in his last
never
time
done
out.
That ever, though.
Trinaldo's one of those guys that never leaves your in front of you.
I know, but he's striking a lot with it. He's using his range. He throws kicks. He's not really using it with wrestling.
He's usually really busy right in front of you. He can really mix it up. Trinaldo's going to win this fight. So I've got Trinaldo in this one. Matt's got Dwight Grant. He puts words in my mouth. We're really having a great night making these picks, making Genesis references. Me eating sticks of cheese. Big time fight coming up this weekend. Split on the pick, but I'll tell you something that we're not split on, and we can definitely agree on. This main event between Paulo Costa and Marvin Vittori. I can't wait for it. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, and as we always say, let's get into it. Absolute barn burner. Featherweight coming up this weekend. We have Bruce Leroy, Alex Caceres, who's had competitive fights against some of the best guys in this division, in this division's history, really. Taking on Sting, Sungwoo Choi. And while I don't know if he's going to fly in from the top ropes and put in whatever Sting's finisher is, what I can tell you is if you went to a scenario in 2019 and said, Craig, Matt, Sungwoo Choi is going to go on a heater of a run. He's going to look like a future top 15 guy. And oh, by the way, Alex Caceres is going to do the same thing. We would have said you're absolutely insane. Like, it wouldn't have made any sense. You would have broken my brain. What do you think about that?
It would have been insane because Alex Caceres at that point was just kind of a 50-50 fighter. Like, yeah, he had had big opportunities. He had been in fun fights. But for the most part, you were just throwing Alex Caceres out there and almost build up another guy off of his name. But Alex Caceres has kind of had this late career resurgence as of late, and it's really refreshing to see, because how many times has there been just exciting MMA fighters where we say, goodness, if they could just put it all together, then they'd really be able to go on a run. Caceres was the definition of that fighter. It was like, okay, he might have been brought in a little bit too early, but we can learn on the job. And he was learning on the job, but it feels like at least these last few fights, I'm more confident in Alex Caceres as a fighter, just as an observer. Like, he's got a little bit better takedown defense, he's a little bit more active. It's just everything that Alex Caceres has been doing, it feels like it's been a little bit more refined throughout the last couple years. It's refreshing to see, because I gotta be honest, I completely written him off. I never thought we were gonna see those marked improvements from Alex Caceres, but he has completely proven me wrong, and I couldn't be happier about it.
Well, the weirdest thing about Caceres, he gets out-grappled by Jason Knight, like, big time. Like, Knight's schooling on him, but can't really get the submission. Then he fights Chrome Gracie, and it's like, okay, well, Gracie's good, and he's coming over from Ryzen, and we have, you know, big expectations. Then he goes in there and blows the doors off Caceres. Now Caceres is almost a 50-50 fighter, not just in, like, your memory, my memory, and everybody else's, but actually by record. He's, like, going on a Randy Marcos trend. And then all of a sudden, four big wins against guys that can grapple. That's the weirdest part. So the four wins, Steven Ocho Peterson, Chase Hooper, Austin Springer, Kevin Kroom. Kevin Kroom looked like he had never run, 2 feet in his life by the end of that fight. Like, the cardio and the pace, Alex Caceres makes you fight his fight, and that's the scariest thing when you fight a guy like that. But for Sungmoo Choi, the guy comes into the UFC and he loses two in a row, and you go, okay, well, he loses to Mavzar Evloev.
You may have heard of him.
A, you must have thought Choi was pretty good if you're going to match him up with Evloev. And then B, he loses to Gavin Tucker in a fight where he had certain successes in that fight before he gets caught and submitted, a guy that we saw at Fight League Atlantic 2 this weekend.
I have to say this when I think about Sungmoo Choi. I always go back to, it was some post-fight video that they had after the Gavin Tucker-Sungmoo Choi fight. And Gavin Tucker was training at TriStar at the time, so Furasahabi was in his corner. And I remember vividly, these words will never leave my head. Furasahabi's out back and he goes, that kid's gonna be really good. Like, I know he's 0-2 in the UFC, but like, from what we saw, we really think he's gonna have a high ceiling. And listen, I don't put that much stock into stuff like that, but it stayed in the back of my mind. And I just kind of thought, like, oh, I wonder if Sungmoo Choi will ever develop. Now, to me, I didn't think it was there. I thought, okay, you lose to Mavzar Evloev, that's one thing. But just the way he got out-grappled and the fight sort of wore on him in the Gavin Tucker fight, it was one of those performances that it's like, okay, you better look good in your next fight or you're gone. Sungmoo Choi looked almost like a completely different fighter as of late.
He mopped the floor with Suman Mokhtarian. Now, again, it's Suman Mokhtarian, but
there's a name in there that matters, and it looks even better now.
I'm a wrestler. I'm a striker. I beat Suman everywhere. I beat Yusuf Zalal at everything, and then I fight Julian Arosa. Now, Julian's a 50-50 fighter. Sometimes he beats Charles Jourdain. Sometimes he loses to guys you've never heard of. But the point of this is, Sungmoo Choi looked amazing. We brought in the sting. So can the stinger sting this weekend like it did in my hand a couple of weeks ago and it blew up like a blown up glove?
So the last thing I want to say about that Choi win over Julian Arosa is that at least that's a win that we can go back on and talk about in the future. You know what I mean? Like, that's not a performance that Sungmoo Choi just had and is sort of lost on everybody. If you go out there and knock out Julian Arosa, we're going to continue to talk about that for a long time, because yes, Julian Arosa's lost by stoppage. He might not be the greatest fighter ever, but to beat a guy like that by stoppage is just a really impressive feat for any prospect to do. It proves that you must have good power. You have to have at least a good level of cardio. I understand the fight was over pretty quick, but you know what I mean? Like, Julian Arosa is not an easy night in the office for anybody, and a win over him really does mean a lot to me. I know he has a lot of stoppage losses, and again, if you're going to beat him, you're going to beat him like Sungmoo Choi did, but that's one of those wins that I can always look to and think, wow, if you can beat a guy like Julian Arosa, you can there's a place for you in the UFC. I guess that's what I'm trying to say.
Well, the neat thing too, I mean, Sungmoo Choi has been getting it done with his team, and he continues kind of on that same path that he was on before the Arosa fight, so on and so forth. The most interesting thing that I saw when I did a quick IG search was the fact that Alex Caceres just opened his own gym in Florida. So I threw that one in there. It's on the second graphic that pops up throughout. Not really with the MMA lab. I'm sure he's gotten rounds in with some of the guys there. Giant names in some of the lower weight classes too. But good for Alex Caceres, man. The guy's turned his career around. He's a very fun fighter and he's going to be around for a long time. You don't go from a 4-fight losing streak to lose to a guy like Sungmoo Choi and then you're gone. Same thing for Choi. You lose to Alex Caceres, it's definitely not over for you. Like, we're starting to get close to the rankings at 145. We're starting to have fun fights. You know, the winner of this could fight Gavin Tucker again? Like, we're starting to get up there. I don't know. A lot of fun fights. But Matt, when I look at the odds for this one, Caceres open a +155 underdog. He's a +227 right now. So a little bit of shade over there. Sungwoo Choi open a -180. He's roughly a -287. The Tapology votes, 824 total votes, 77% choice, 64% by decision, 29% by knockout. For the 23% that have Caceres, 73% by decision. Caceres has been getting it done against guys that you kind of win one, you lose one. Like, it's tough to tell. Kevin Kroom sometimes can submit Roosevelt Roberts. He can lose to the Derek Minners. Like, he's one of those type of fighters. And if you look at it for the rest of the guys, you can make the same comparisons. Maybe I'm way overvaluing Sungwoo Choi, but I still, and I know I said this before his last fight, I think Sungwoo Choi still has a really high ceiling, and I really like, I like him quite a bit. Against a lot of guys in this division, I think he's got a great chance against Caceres.
And he's still a young guy, too. He is adding new things to his game, and he's proved that just throughout his UFC tenure. He's, what, 5 fights into it, and he looks like a much improved fighter than he did when he had his introduction against Evloev, what, 3 years ago? Like, it hasn't been that long, and he's made massive steps in his game, and I expect him to make even more improvements as he progresses. This is what I will say about Caceres. All day long, I've been trying to think of, like, a game plan for Caceres to win, because I kind of wanted to be a hipster. I was going to have an underdog pick in this one. But it is tough. If you look at the last 4 opponents Caceres has had, they do have big weaknesses. All those fighters have something that you can point to that Alex Caceres does quite a bit better than them. Other than just volume strike on the outside, and honestly, Sungwoo Choi is a pretty good striker on the outside, Alex Caceres doesn't have a really big X factor that he really pulls away from Sungwoo Choi in this fight. On some of the grappling exchanges, I actually think could be kind of fun in this, because Caceres can get held down, but he can force scrambles sometimes. I think that could be really fun. But Sungwoo Choi, I think, is the much more physically dominant fighter. So I think in the clinch, he's going to have success. I think he's a much more powerful fighter. So if he gets on the inside of Caceres' range, he'll have success. I just like the overall game of Choi in this matchup.
The scariest thing is, this fight reminds me a lot of Ludwig Klein last weekend against Nate Landwehr, where you go, okay, I think I know where this prospect is at. Oh, apparently I don't, and the guy's got no cardio. So I'm going with Choi, but again, I have reservations just off of that one from last week kind of reverberating here, but I do like Choi in terms of the stand-up, the wrestling, the scrambling. Caceres, though, he's one of those guys like Andrei Arlovsky did last weekend, where we can just kind of pitter-patter, throw the volume, not take a lot of damage, and end up winning another decision fight.
There's a thing to be said about a guy who's just been around for a long time. It's not like Alex Caceres has been cut from the UFC 4 times and got brought back. Like, he's
not Julian Arosa.
No, he's been in this organization the whole time. And yeah, the record might not be great, and he's not really in the Matt Brown category of, like, you've just been fighting the best, so of course your record's gonna be bad. But, like, Alex Caceres has been around for a while, and I'm sure...
Split decision loss to Yair Rodriguez.
Exactly. Like, Alex Caceres is going to be capable to pull off a win in this fight. I just think the overall, just Choi is an impressive prospect, I think, and I really do think that if he does continue to make improvements like he has in the past, he really could find himself in the rankings at some point.
Both of us going with South Korea's Sungwoo Choi to get the win. We also have South Korea's Jun Young Park on this card. He's got a very interesting fight against Gregory Rodriguez. If you missed that, check it out. And hey, big time main event coming up. You have Marvin Vettori taking on Paulo Costa. You're not going to want to miss it. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Bit of a weird fight coming up this weekend. We have Jessica Rose Clark taking on Jocelyn Edwards, La Pantera, representing Panama. She got a big win in her UFC debut, and she looked absolutely amazing against Wu Yanan. And then her last time out, they matched her up against one of the better prospects in this division in Carol Hossa, who ended up beating poor Rowdy Betch Cohea in a retirement fight. So, little bit of a return back down to earth for Jocelyn Edwards after losing that fight. And listen, these women have kind of compared or, you know, parallel type of careers, because for Edward, a lot of success outside of the UFC. Now, the same thing can't be said, because for Edwards, she lost a fight to Sarah Alpar. For Jessica Rose Clark, she beat the brakes off of Sarah Alpar and almost lost by disqualification, but it was not an illegal knee, so a great check on that one. But for Rose Clark, I have such a hard time when I look at her career to try and figure out, okay, what is she the greatest at? Because one thing that it isn't is activity. We haven't seen her a lot in the cage.
I'm calling myself out right now. I'm going to throw myself in the same category as you with Chun Young Park. When you said, hey, I just don't have a great read on him. I don't have a good read on Jessica Rose Clark, and I'm more than comfortable with admitting that. It's the overall combination of her, just she hasn't been very active in the cage. I don't know what weight class she's really suited for because she's fought at 135. She's fought at 125. And the thing about Rose Clark is that she's had big opportunities against really big fighters. And normally, when you're a fighter who's had big opportunities against big names, and you lose those fights, some of your shine does get diminished. But it does feel like with Rose Clark, she's kind of in that like Charles Rosa category where like it doesn't really matter what happens. There's still going to be some sort of prestige next to your name.
You can call me Jessica Rose. You can call me Jessica Rose Clark. You can call me Rose Clark, Matt. In this fight though, again, for Jocelyn Edwards, it might be, you know, a case where a lot of people don't know her because she is that prospect. She only has two fights under her belt. And if you look at it for Clark, she's one of those fighters that's kind of fought on the marquee. She's had a big opportunity to become a star. She beat Beck Rawlings in her UFC debut, so there is that. But then I look at the 5-1 in for both these women, and it's inactivity across the board. That Beck Rawlings split decision win was almost 4 years ago. Then for Clark, she beats Paige VanZant, coming out party. She loses to Jessica Ai. Then 2 years ago, she lost to Pani Kanzad. Then a year ago, she lost to Sarah Alper. You can see where I'm coming from. Sorry, she beat Sarah Alper. For Edwards, 3 years ago, she beat Brenda Gonzalez. Maybe at that time it was Brenda Gonzalez Means. Then she loses to Sarah Alper almost 3 years ago. Then she beats Pamela Gonzalez a year and 3 months ago. That was a crazy body kick knockout. Then she beats Wu Yanan. That was, what, 6 months ago? And then, you know, a number of months ago, she fought Bang Bang, Wu Yanan, and then the fight against Carol Hosa. So, Edwards gets a chance to kind of get rejuvenated. Train at King's MMA a little bit more consistency with great training partners. Then you're getting ready for a fight against somebody who, in Clark, in her fight, she just kind of doesn't go away.
That's the best way of describing Clark. She just moves forward. And yes, she'll wrestle. Yes, she'll strike. But it's just that pressure. And she really relies on that pressure breaking her opponent. And it was really interesting. It felt like her fight against Jessica Ai was almost built up like it was a title eliminator. It was the early days of the weight class. And Clark had quite a bit of momentum. When you beat someone like Paige VanZant, who has a massive name, it's going to get you in the headlines. And
I'm sure there's a lot of fans out there that really did think that.
Oh, 100%. And the thing with Clark going into that matchup was, okay, you're the young prospect, you have a lot of hype, you're fighting the more established vet, but the vet sort of seems to be on their way out. She had won a split decision over Kalindra Fahea, I think her name is. It was a very close fight. I thought Jessica Ai lost it, but anyways, Rose Clark ended up getting out Rose Clark, and that was what was really unfortunate. This is the thing that I can't stand in MMA. It's when your specialty gets used against you. And the thing about Clark is that her style is ugly. She uses her forward pressure with her boxing and her wrestling. And the fact that Jessica Ai was really able to use Clark's style against her was a little bit concerning. And the thing about Clark, when you really want to break down her record, is look at who her wins are against. Paige VanZant, Beck Rawlings, and Sarah Alper. Those are all UFC fighters, but those aren't great fighters. Like, when we look back at the Sungmoo Choi fight, he's got that knockout win over Julian Arosa. That's a performance we can talk about. That's something I put stock into. I can't put a ton of stock in Rose Clark beating Van Zant years ago by decision at a different weight class. It's just, with Clark, that's why I feel like I don't have a very good read on her. It's her losses are to good fighters, but her wins are over, I would say, underwhelming talent as well, and that's why I have a such hard time with this fight, because I could see Clark going in there and fighting one of those grueling styles where Edwards can't get any range on her strikes, she's really struggling with the, oh, I'm going from takedown defense to striking, and Clark's able to just go out there and win like a 29-28, and it gives her a little bit of hype back. But the flip side is, she eats a ton of damage on her way into range, she's never able to really implement her wrestling, and she just turned into a boxer against Edwards, and I think Edwards is a much superior striker.
Edwards' kickboxing is amazing, and when I looked at her coming into the UFC, I was like, wow, this is a fighter that, it's can't miss TV, and that's why this fight is on the main card, not on the prelims, because I do expect a lot of fireworks out of this one. For Clark, again, forward pressure doesn't give you an inch. You saw that in her last fight. She looked absolutely amazing. For Edwards, when she's on, it's, again, like it's popping popcorn, just like this fight is, and it's something that you have to see. So the odds in this one, Clark opened a minus 150, she's minus 136 or thereabouts on best fight odds. For Edwards, she opened a plus 130, she's a plus 110. If we have a look at the Tapology votes, surprise to us as it is to you, 880 total votes, 67% Clark, 86% Howard to win by decision. For the 33% that have Edwards, 87% Howard to win by decision. So a lot of people predicting a decision. Edwards, to me, it's got to be the takedown defense. That's the biggest glaring hole. You saw that in her fight against Carol Hossa. For Clark, how can you strike against somebody who's so dynamic on the feet? Like, there's one big avenue for Clark. Same can be said for Edwards.
You're not going to like what I'm about to say, but I really want to get your opinion on this. Do you think Edwards looked better in her loss than she did in her win? Because hear me out. She looked good against Wu Yanan, but that was a weird fight. Like, Wu Yanan's moving backwards the whole time. Edwards is kind of chasing her. Like, Edwards is definitely the better fighter when it's all said and done. I'm not trying to argue she lost that fight. Don't get what I'm saying wrong. What I am saying, though, is that she landed a lot of clean shots in that fight. It was just a weird, weird, weird performance. And the fact that she was able to go out there and at least last 15 minutes against Carol Hossa on 2 weeks' notice, I think that was impressive. That's all I'm trying to say. With Edwards, it is odd because that fight against Yanan was so strange. And her loss to Carol Hossa, that's one of those fights you can't really put a lot of stock into because, again, I think Carol Hossa is one of those, like, top-tier bantamweights. Like, hey, if you don't know how good she is yet, it's just because you haven't been watching type of fighters. So, I know Edwards is the underdog in this fight, but I really don't look at it that way. I look at the time off for Clark. I look at just the inconsistency in her level of opposition and the fact that the last time I saw her out, yes, she looked good against Sarah Alper, but... Sarah Alper, it's a much different fighter than Edwards. I think if Edwards can use her movement to defend the takedowns, she should be able to win this fight.
That's a big if. I have Edwards in this one too, but it's one of the least confident picks that's on this one. I like the fight. I think matchmaking's great. Again, there's a path to victory for either fighter. Let us know down below in the comments section who you have. This could be a question mark, kicks, garbage time type of a pick. So you're going to want to tune in 2 hours before the prelims here on the channel. Let us know who you have. Both of us going with Panama's Joslyn Edwards to get the win. Big time main event. Vettori taking on Costa. Can't wait for it. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
Attention listeners across the galaxy, all the way from Australia to Houston, do we have a pew problem? If so, our friends at Manscaped have cleared you for takeoff with their fourth generation of brand new lawnmower 4.0. Kick your pubes to the next planet with the Performance Package 4.0 that Matt has in his hands right there. The orbits in your pants will feel like you're in zero gravity when you use the best tools for the job from the leaders in male grooming. Join the 2 million men worldwide who trust Manscaped to get your rocket ready for takeoff by going to manscaped.com. And you're going to get 20% off and free shipping with the code FNP. Now, Matt, we've all been there, and we've needed confidence in the manly departments. Now, I've been known to be a shower shaver, and the worst part about it is I hit up my big brand stores, and I go, you know what? I want to buy some milk, and I want to buy some bread, and I want to buy some, you know, well, you can't actually get this at the big box stores, but Amber Mist, cheese, all different things. Now, I haven't eaten cheese, you know, slice over on the corner. You can buy those there. You can also buy really bad razors there. And I've been guilty of it. I go there, I buy it, I get the kit, I'm feeling good about myself. I go into the shower where it's dark. I'm going, not for my gooch, but I'm going for my groin. And we're just right up there against the groin. And when you nick that stuff, boy, oh boy, does it look like a sea of red. It looks the same color as Matt's jersey, but he's not wearing a jersey dyed in my ball blood. It is the fact that it gets nasty down there, Matt. If you're ready for an out-of-world experience, look no further than Performance Package 4.0. And I can tell you this. So, we open it up. Let's check out some of the goods. You have the Crop Preserver Ball Deodorant. Now, I'm in a situation right now where I could probably go for some. Depends on what the wife says, what I'm feeling, how frisky it gets. But it goes on like a bit of a salve. You just put that on there, slap it on, and it's going to just make it a nice day. But if you want the little pick-me-up, maybe you're on the go. And you're like, hey, I need the Crop Reviver Ball Toner. It's a little bit of a spritz here and there. What'll it do for you?
It'll just pick your day up and make it a little bit better. It'll add that little hint of confidence that you felt like you needed before you left the house.
Lawnmower 4.0. It's on right now. 4000K LED spotlight. Yeah, that's right. You don't want to stare directly into it. But that's kind of something that I think we can all rally around is the fact that showers probably aren't the best place to see what you're doing. The fact that you get the advanced skin safe technology, ceramic blade, you don't have to worry about, hey, If it gets in the water, now what's going to happen? The other thing is you can pop it off, clean it out, and oil the motor. So those are definitely big things for me that I take into account. With the big box brand stuff, I'm kind of just throwing the money away. And, well, if I nick my nuts, I nick them, and now I'm out of commission. The other thing that they have that just so happens not to be in the Performance Package 4.0 at this very moment, you'll get it, because I was using it in the office, is the Weed Whacker. Now, the Weed Whacker is something I use every week.
You did use it recently.
Yeah, I did use it. You can't hear all the nose hair. I did actually use it yesterday. So the Weed Whacker is another tool that you can add in there. 9,000 RPM motor, 360-degree technology. The other nice thing about it, look at that. You can service what you got. And that's the best part about it. Service is a big thing to me in life. So listen, you check it out. Aboard Harry Balls and Buzz Lightyear that Woody with Manscaped Matt. Get 20% off free shipping with code FNP at manscaped.com. That's 20% off and free shipping with code FNP at manscaped.com. Your digging balls need some help. For a clean Trinity and beyond, your space balls will thank you. Matt, big time fights in the co-main and main. Grant Dawson taking on Ricky Glenn. And in the main event, Paulo Costa taking on Marvin Vettori. I can't wait for it. So as we always say with Fight Night Picks, let's get into it. Big time fight coming up in the lightweight division this weekend. Might be a little bit of a surprise to some people. We have Grant Dawson, the forever prospect. He's taking on Tricky Ricky Glenn. It's no longer Rick. He changed it his last fight out. There's a great story about that. James Lynch did an interview with him about why he changed his name. And it's funny. And you got to give shouts where it's due to the Canadians and the good guys in the game. But Matt, I love this fight because for Glenn, his last time out, he took on Joaquim Silva, and in that one, he knocked him the F out. And it was a return for a guy who had been out due to injuries. He used to train at Team Alpha Male and then a little bit at Pura Vida BJJ, but he wasn't in California anymore. He moved back home. You know, we're putting rounds in Iowa, and we're getting ready for some fights. And for Glenn, he looked great. And I was worried and hesitant about him in that fight. Everything was gone. This is Gavin Tucker-esque Rick Glenn. Sorry, Ricky. And for Grant Dawson, I always worried about him. You know, there are always USADA issues, this, that, and the other. There are always weight issues at 145. He goes out, he fights a guy that if you're a Fight Night Picks fan, you know I'm all over Leonardo Santos. And in that fight, it was like, oh, shed a tear for Leonardo. And in that one, it was disgusting. Grant Dawson looked absolutely amazing. He's a guy that the two things that I worry about with Grant Dawson, striking defense against boxers, cardio, and making the weight on the scales on Friday. Those are the three big things that I worry about, because when he defends himself, he brings his hands up and he just kind of stops. And if you can hit around him, you got a good chance.
The best way I can describe Grant Dawson's defense is, and I'm sorry people might not like the basketball references, but this will be the last one. When Giannis shoots, it's very mechanical. It's like, okay, this is what I do. And if it goes in, great. If not, that's fine. Jason Tatum, like, moves his wrist like an actual shooter does. He has a feel for it. Some guys with their striking defense, think of, like, Anderson Silva in his prime. He's got trunk movement. He has head movement. And he has his hands, too. With Grant Dawson, it was a great point. It is just a lot of that, like, hands up. Where my hands are, yeah, if you hit that, that's fine. But if you have any kind of striking IQ, and if you can work around a guy's defense, like Ricky Glenn definitely can, then there are definitely holes there from a guy like Grant Dawson. But the thing about Dawson, and you set it up perfectly, is that the only concerns I have is his weight, which at 155 I don't really worry about, his gas tank, which at 155 I worry about a lot less, and his striking defense, which, yes, I'm still going to worry about in this fight, but I gotta be honest, I was worried about Grant Dawson moving up to 155 pounds. I thought, you're a really dominant wrestler, you rely a lot on your physicality. Maybe against those bigger guys it will be tough. Leonardo Santos is a pretty big lightweight, though. Like, a really big lightweight. And the fact that Grant Dawson was able to hold his own in some of those grappling exchanges just reassured that move up in weight. How many times have we seen... Darren Till's a great example. You see a guy move up in weight, you think it's going to work out. Maybe it does for a little bit. But after you start fighting the elite of the elite, some of the chinks in the armor start to show and some of the cracks do. I don't think Grant Dawson's going to be one of these fighters where he's going to stick around at 155 pounds for 2-3 fights, maybe lose once, then all of a sudden think, hey, I've got to move back down. I really do think that if he does let his body grow into this weight class, because I do think he has a little bit more growing to do. I don't think it's like, okay, I'm a lightweight now, this is it. Like, you can still grow a little bit afterwards. It's kind of like when Poirier fought Holloway. Poirier settled into lightweight a little bit more. You could tell he was the thicker guy, whereas Holloway was just going from I fight at 145 too. I'm fighting at 155 now. He was just cutting less weight, if that makes any sense. So for me, a lot of the questions that I had about Grant Dawson moving up to lightweight were completely eliminated in his last fight too. And that's why I'm so excited for this matchup. It's two fighters that I thought I knew a lot about, but they still add new things and they still find a way to keep their fights exciting.
Ricky Glenn could have called it quits when he was a World Series champ and I would have gone, oh, that guy's a pretty good fighter. He could have called it quits after he lost to who? Pick any of his losses. When he lost to Miles Jury and then he comes out and beats Dennis Bermudez. Or when he loses to Kevin Aguilar by decision, who's no longer in the UFC. And then he comes out and he beats Joaquim Silva. And Joaquim Silva is a one-quitter hitter. He's a one-pump chump. He's a guy that's in it to win it. And then he's off the bed. And his
hit
lady's
it, quit
like,
it, you'd say?
His lady's like, but Joaquim, what about me?
Wow.
So when I look at this fight, it is one of those ones where, for Glenn, so dynamic and a very, very rangy guy. He was at 145. Same can be said at 155. And he has finishing ability to boot.
Is it fair to say he's the Tim Means of lightweight? He doesn't throw the elbows at him, but they're both very volume-heavy strikers. They have good boxing on the inside. They have good grappling. It's not a perfect comparison, but I think it's a sound one. Because what Rick Glenn does is, on the inside, he has weapons to deal with it. On the outside, he has weapons to deal with it. The thing I really like about Ricky's game as a whole is that it's all about my move and then my counter move, and it is very NBA that way, and I think that's why I appreciate
you gotta stop
with
the references.
I'm done now, don't worry. The thing about Ricky Glenn though is that I really like his game, but it still is his game. He improves on the things that he does really, really well, but I don't look at Glenn and I don't see him adding massive new areas into his game. I know we've talked a lot about his improvements, but it's not like his improvements are, I'm all of a sudden adding like a kicking game, like Brennan Allen did when we went to Sanford, you know? Like, he's added more power with the move up in weight, and I feel like he's another case where I'm just cutting less weight, I'm more comfortable here, I'm focused less on just making weight in my training camp, and now I'm focused more on working on my skills, and that's why I think Glenn's look good at 155. I think this could be fight of the night, honestly, and I really do think this is a good primer for the main event, because if Grant Dawson's gonna win, it's probably gonna be a one-sided fight. I hate to say that, but he's probably gonna get an initial takedown. He's got phenomenal ground and pound.
Gets in a mount? Yikes.
Exactly. Like, that's the thing about Dawson. When he gets in a mount, he makes it count. There's not just like a, oh, I'm gonna wait here, like the amateur rules of New Brunswick, where there's no head strikes on the ground, so guys would get in full mount and like try to hit the guy in the shoulder.
New Brunswick have an advanced amateur
now,
rule set?
I'm so glad you asked, Craig. Yes, they do. Now, with Grant Dawson, though, he is one of those fighters where when he gets to that top position, he makes every second count. And that's why if he's able to get there early, I think he's going to be able to drain Glenn to the point where Glenn won't have that knockout power in the second and third round. And that's why I think Dawson is such a big favorite in this fight.
Yeah, the odds. Dawson open a minus 400 favorite. He's a minus 347 right now. For Tricky Ricky, open a plus 300. He's a plus 266. If we go have a look at Tapology, I'm not surprised by it. 851 total votes, 95% Dawson, 57% by decision, 24% by submission, 12% by knockout. Do the percentages add up? I don't know. It's Tapology. Over the 5% that have Glenn, 44% by decision, 31% by knockout. I like Grant Dawson in this one. I don't have the big cardio concerns that I used to have. Again, Rick Glenn's a finisher, so if you like Glenn, cool beans, bro. But for me, yeah, I like KGD Grant Dawson in this one.
So I guess I'm just going to end this on a question for you. When you look at Grant Dawson in this division, like, his style is kind of Gregor Gillespie-ish, right? Like, they don't do everything the same, but they fight in a similar manner. Do you think Grant Dawson could be a ranked fighter at lightweight, or do you think he had a higher ceiling down at featherweight?
Nah, lightweight's where it's at. Okay, when you don't have to worry about the cardio, you should be good to go, Matt. Both of us going with Grant Dawson to bring back the win of Glory MMA and Fitness. Don't tell him he's up after two rounds. Just play with his brain. Don't Tim Elliott him. Grant Dawson is the pick here. Big time fight in our main event that you're not going to want to miss. Vettori taking on Costa for the winner of the losers, I guess we could say, Matt. I can't wait for it. Let's keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Absolutely banging main event, and we have been waiting for this at Fight Night Picks. As always, one half of your host, new Craig Allen. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Craig Allen FNP. With me to my left, to your right, Matt Allen FNP. We got a challenge out there to all the Fight Night Picks fans and you casual fans out there. We love you.
We do.
Because listen, we want to add in an extra show with Dana White's Contender Series. 30,000 subscribers. I'm so excited I can't say it. We'll have it there. I think we can do it. add in a sub and a like, and we will thank you with our new show. Now, Matt, coming up this weekend, we have the best main event that we've had since, what, the last pay-per-view? We have Paulo Costa coming off of an unsuccessful title bid against Israel Adesanya, what seems like a very long time ago, taking on Marvin Vettori coming off of an unsuccessful title bid against Israel Adesanya, but it wasn't that long ago. So, couple of guys definitely able to get it done. For Paulo Costa, look no further than the way that he's doing it. Wins in the UFC over Gareth McLennan. McClellan. You've got Oluwole Bamboje. You've got Johnny Hendricks, a weird fight 4 years ago. He fought Uriah Hall over 3 years ago. He fought Yoel Romero, his last win over 2 years ago. Beat him by decision. Wild fight. And then he loses to Adesanya about a year ago. So long periods of inactivity for Paulo Costa. One of the most handsome men in MMA. For Marvin Vettori, it's the activity that gets you going. I mean, in his 5-1 in, beats Aldierte Sanchez by decision, beats Carl Robertson, a guy who he hates, and finished him, beat Jack Hermanson in a fight of the night that was insane, a fight of the night, beat Kevin Holland by decision, and then for the title, he loses to Adesanya, where, listen, it was a frustrating fight for Vettori. He just couldn't implement his game plan, and Adesanya fought great behind that black line, just working side to side. Did a great job. Against Paulo Costa, Israel Adesanya hardly even threw a punch. Totally outkicked him, threw the kitchen sink at him in terms of his strikes, and finished him in that fight. A very impressive performance by one of the best middleweights that we've seen in a very long time. I know Robert Whittaker has that kind of knocking on the door right now, wanting that opportunity again. But the weird thing is, for Costa, he's been out for quite a while. He's been booked in some fights, one of which with Robert Whittaker. So I can't wait for this one. Costa ranked number 2, but whatever that is. You've got Vettori at number 5. I see this one as a great fight. This is one that people are going to remember after 2021's over. Matt, I'll hand it off to you. I love the fight.
Are these the two most successful, like, stupid jacked MMA fighters in the roster? It just, like, muscles aren't something I ever think of when I make a prediction.
No, Mac, where you at?
But, yeah, like, muscles aren't something I ever think of when I make a prediction. It's like, hey, it's normally a negative, if anything. Paulo Costa, for the size of him, great power, pretty good cardio, good output. Like, a guy his size shouldn't be able to throw hundreds of punches in a 15-minute fight, but he is able to do it. Marvin Vettori, big jack strong guy, not that flexible. I doubt he has great cardio. Oh, what's that? He never gets tired in 25-minute fights. He can push a pace like few other fighters. I think this fight's going to be absolutely phenomenal. I really do. And it's really interesting when you really start to break down the X's and O's, because both guys are going to have a lot of areas where they can have success in. I don't think just because Paulo Costa didn't look good against Israel Adesanya, you can point to that fight and say, hey, Marvin Vettori is going to fight a similar fight than Israel Adesanya. Because here's the thing, and we both got to say this right now. Paulo Costa can't really take that much from Adesanya to use against Vettori. And Vettori can't use that much Adesanya used against Costa just because none of these three fighters fight that similar of a style. Like, yes, Costa and Adesanya are both primary strikers. They both have some flashiness to it. But the way they choose to strike are both very different. So, I guess I want to say that I didn't put a lot of stock in both guys' last fights to try to predict this one, if that makes any sense. Because for Vettori, he's almost going to have to fight this fight like he did Kevin Holland, which is crazy to think, because that's going to be a really dangerous way to fight Paulo Costa. And for Costa, you want to point to the Uriah Hall fight as like, hey, he's going to have to get through some volume. He might need to eat a shot to give a shot. But I always go to the Yoel Romero one, because Yoel Romero at that point was probably the scariest middleweight ever. He still had the muscles. He still had some of the prestige. I understand he wasn't like peak prime Yoel Romero, but that Yoel could have a fun fight with anybody. And the way Paulo Costa was able to march him down, defend takedowns, eat power, and respond with power. Like, if that guy shows up this weekend, Marvin Vettori's got a really, really hard fight on his hands. But if the Marvin Vettori who showed up against Carl Roberson shows up this weekend, who is less trying to strike his way into the clinch and more just trying to use his takedowns as a method to submit his opponent, then I think Costa has a long night ahead of him.
If you think we're excited for this, how pumped do you think Walid Ismail is for this one? Like, that guy's probably selling pay-per-views in Brazil, and it's not even a pay-per-view event. Like, that guy is probably off the charts excited. Listen, I do love this fight, and when I look at it for Costa, you're right. I mean, against a great grappler, a world-class grappler who rarely uses it.
Yeah.
Yoel Romero wasn't really able to get the takedown in that fight. Costa was able to make it a little bit of his fight. Was it a close fight?
Yes.
Yeah, it was a very close fight. Was it a 3-round fight? Yeah, it was. And for Paulo Costa, that's the one weird knock that I have against him, because when he was with Jungle Fights, when he was with different organizations in Brazil, yes, he was a champion, Go back and look if those were 5-round fights. They weren't. They were 3-round fights. And for Vettori, he has that 5-round experience in his back pocket. He's been in those fights. And he's fought very, very good levels of competition in the UFC. That's the other kind of thing where I go, okay, Oluwole Bamboje, Johnny Hendricks at the end of the big rig era, Uriah Hall, Romero, those are the good wins. And those are definitely deserving of not just a title shot, but even a spot in the rankings too.
I think the top tier wins of Costa are far better than the top tier wins of Vettori. That's my big issue with this fight. If Marvin Vettori had one win over a top five guy that I had a lot of confidence in,
Jack Hermanson,
I would think he blew the doors off Paulo Costa. But the thing is that Jack Hermanson has an obvious weakness. He's uncomfortable on his feet, and he doesn't have the best wrestling in the world. So if you're Marvin Vettori, your style's kind of built perfectly for fighting a guy like Jack Hermanson, and he looked great in that performance. And I'm going to say this right now. I thought Hermanson was going to destroy Marvin Vettori, and that completely changed my opinion of Marvin Vettori, and that is the performance that I am putting a lot of stock into, because if Vettori can at least wear on Costa like he was able to Hermanson, who has a really good gas tank himself, then I do think there's a big path to victory, or a really clear path to victory, I should say, for Marvin Vettori. This is my problem I have with Vettori, though, and it's going to be called the Kevin Holland 5-round problem, because both guys who have fought Kevin Holland for 5 rounds ran into this. There was one flurry in the 5th round that Marvin Vettori ate from Kevin Holland that, like, landed really, really clean and landed on the chin, like, rattle, rattle, rattle. Now, Kevin Holland at 185 doesn't have absurd knockout power. He has weird power where, like, he can knock you out off his back, but
Great cardio because he shows up 183.5.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, but a radio station.
But the thing with Kevin Holland is, we both like Kevin Holland. It's not like he's not a good fighter, but at 185, there's some holes in his game that can get taken advantage of, and that's what Marvin Vettori was able to do. It's not like Marvin Vettori went out there and finished Kevin Holland. He just kind of laid on top of him, ground and pounded him. It was a good win. I expected a lot more out of Marvin Vettori personally in that, and that's the only thing that's making me hesitant about this pick. And the other thing I will say, just because I feel like we have to mention it, Marvin Vettori hasn't accepted the fact that he lost to Israel Adesanya, and I don't like that at all. That's something I really, really dislike. When a fighter can't just be like, hey, I lost, these are the improvements I can make, and then we can move on from it. I just don't like how Marvin Vettori's been like, hey, he didn't really beat me, like, I was doing great in that fight. That's just another area of concern, but for me, Marvin Vettori should be able to win this fight until he doesn't. And I know we say that sometimes, but Marvin Vettori should be able to win rounds from Paulo. He's got great output, he's got really good wrestling, and he has the ability to mix this fight up. I just worry about the fact that Marvin Vettori has a great chin. And the reason I know Vettori has a great chin is because he's eaten clean shots in the past, and I don't like him eating clean shots against a guy like Costa. That's the only red flag, is that Marvin Vettori has eaten big shots. It's just, I don't know if Costa's the guy you can eat big shots against.
Well, my big question to you is, when you kind of roll around in bed and you kind of get
every
the crusties
night
and the Sandman out of your eye, and then you really get moving, what's the thing that gets you up in the morning? It's to deliver great MMA videos, right?
Coffee first, but yes, normally the MMA content second.
For Marvin Vettori, it's probably a giant shot of espresso, and it's Israel Adesanya didn't beat me. That's just what gets him up in the morning. And if I have to liken him to a record that, yeah, I actually have in my real collection, farewell to the first golden era, the Mamas and the Papas. There's a couple songs on here, but go where you want to go. But for me, since Marvin Vettori's been California dreaming, he's really put it together. And I mean, I really do like that Rafael Cordero connection. For some people, they go, okay, well, if you're already a good striker, you're going to accentuate some of your points. For Vettori, it's, we're already a good grappler, we're going to make you a serviceable striker, so you can go out there with a guy like Jack Hermanson, kind of blow the doors off certain people, and just have a shot in some of these fights rather than just going in there like a shot of espresso and wrestling guys, and that's it. It's just top control or bust. And for me, when I look at this fight, Vettori is a guy that's built for a 5-round fight. Paulo Costa is built for 2.5 rounds and sometimes 3.
So just because I'm making this point doesn't mean I'm right, but I am going to die on this hill. I don't think Paulo Costa has bad cardio. I truly don't. I just think he fights with such a crazy uptick of output that he's going to get tired as a result of it. Look at that Yoel Romero fight. Anybody would get tired throwing the shots that Costa threw in that fight. You can't point to a single middleweight on this roster who wouldn't be tired by the end of that fight. Now, yes, Yoel had slightly better cardio, and he was the one winning that fight as it was going on, but still, Yoel Romero wins every 3rd round he's ever been in, except for the ones against Robert Whittaker.
Or that's Phil Davis. Because there's supposed to be 5 rounds.
And Yoel Romero and Bellator just kind of said, like, hey, they
oil
pay me,
water,
right? Yeah. It's just, it's sad to see a fighter who was really good just kind of show up at this stage. It's just, I agree with everything you're saying, and I do think that Vettori, on paper, yes, Vettori should win this fight 10 times out of 10. But the fact that he does eat shots really does worry me. There's a world out there where he's moving forward. Costa hits him with one uppercut, rocks him, and knocks him out with a flurry in the middle of the cage. Like, I don't think Vettori isn't going to get knocked out by Costa. I think he can win a decision, but I definitely think the finishing ability is with Paolo. And I agree with what you said about him adding the components into his game with Kings MMA, but I'm going to flip it a little bit. I like him more defensively with Kings MMA, more than just him adding the offensive part to his striking, because I do think his offensive striking has opened up quite a bit with that transition, but I do think that his defense has been the biggest thing, has been the biggest part of his game to advance.
Costa, open the favorite, Matt. Minus 150. Now he is an underdog at plus 122. The odds have shifted. Vettori, open the underdog. Plus 130. He's now a minus 149 or thereabouts. When we look at the Tapology votes, very, very close, Matt. What is that? 975 total votes. 59% Vettori, 67% by decision. The 41% of Costa voters, what is it? 69% have to win by knockout. Definite path to victory for both guys. I like the track record of Vettori, if I haven't made it obviously clear already. And listen, Israel Adesanya had a great breakdown on this fight too.
Yeah, that's the thing. Izzy, pretty good at breaking down fights, better than you probably think. I want to pick Paulo in this fight because I really do think his power is that kind of an X factor. And I do think he just had a bad night at the office against Israel Adesanya. And I know it's hard to make that argument, but again, you can't look at everything Paulo's done throughout his entire career and then think, oh, he's not going to throw punches against Adesanya, right? Like, I do think he can kind of throw out that performance a little bit. I thought the lights were a little bit too bright for him, but I do agree with your breakdown, and I do think Vittori's probably going to grind his way to a win. Now, if Costa does win this fight, it's going to be via some crazy highlight that's going to be replayed on Twitter for months to come.
Like when he knocked out Big Rig.
Exactly. Like, it will be, like, one solid shot, crazy flurry, and Marvin Vittori's in the shadow realm, but...
You now become a steakhouse baron. Is that still a thing? Is Big Rig steakhouses?
I think that kind of led to his downfall. Marvin Vittori, yeah, I like Marvin Vittori's staying power, but... This is the weird thing. I actually like Paulo Costa's chances against other elite middleweights a little bit better than I do Marvin Vittori's. I just don't like this matchup for Costa.
Give me Costa versus Darren Till next, Matt. Both of us going with Marvin Vittori, the Italian dream, to get the win. I can't wait for the fight. The challenge is out there. 30,000 subscribers. Dana White's Contender Series previews for you.
We're so close.
You can help us out. You can find us on Apple Podcasts and Spotify if you just want to listen to the audio version. You don't want to see our faces. That's fine. I won't take offense to it.
Yeah.
Matt, I absolutely love this weekend's card. I can't wait for these fights and question mark kicks 2 hours before the prelims. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say, let's get into it.